once I went to the North.
All righty. Thank you, everybody, for joining us here on another episode of Extreme Health Radio. We appreciate you guys. We're having a good time here already in the studio with Dr. Steinblok. Thank you, everybody, for joining us, especially in the live chat room. We really appreciate that. We broadcast live every Friday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific time. So if you guys would like to join us and make some friends in the chat room, ask your questions live to our guest, you can do so at extremehealthradio.com/live at 9 a.m. Pacific time. And you can get your questions answered, have some fun, meet some good people. And today we're really excited. We've got Dr. David Steinblok. Before I introduce him, we've got a few things to get to. I want to let everyone know that if they would like to sign up to our newsletter list, a great way to keep up to date with all of our shows is to sign up there. Because we're learning that a lot of people aren't able to see our updates on Facebook. And so in order to see those, you have to interact with the actual updates themselves. A lot of people forget to do that. So the best way to stay up to date with our shows is to sign up to our newsletter list. And you can do that by texting "Get Healthy" to 33444. I don't even have a cell phone, so I don't even know how to text. But that works for most people. So you text "Get Healthy" to 33444. And you can sign up to our newsletter list, and you can join the show that way. Make sure you never miss a show. Today, we've got Dr. David Steinblok, really going to be a fun show. And he's the founder and director of the Brain Therapeutics Medical Clinic. No longer, is it in San Clemente now and not Mission Viejo?
It was in Mission Viejo for 20-some years, and now we've moved here to San Clemente.
It's beautiful, San Clemente.
Everything's here.
And, okay, so moved to San Clemente, California, and he works a lot with brain repair, stroke patients, cerebral palsy, traumatic brain injuries, Parkinson's disease, autism, migraine headaches, Alzheimer's disease. And we're talking before the show, he's been doing a lot of work recently with ALS. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And is that the bulk of the people that you see? Is it ALS?
Well, I've been at this business practicing medicine and trying to help people with these chronic degenerative diseases since 1978.
Uh-huh.
And so I've gone through a lot of different kinds of therapies, anything from nutrition, supplements, vitamins, amino acids, chelation, hyperbaric oxygen. It just goes on and on. There's a long list of alternative and complementary and standard care of therapies that I've delved into and studied and used on thousands of patients. And one of the toughest cases has been amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease.
Uh-huh.
And I'm an inquisitive fellow and innovative, uh-huh. I think creative. And also, I was born and raised on a farm in Iowa, so I have this attitude of, if it's going to be, it's going to be up to me. And so sometime back in 78, I started practicing. I came across a patient came to me with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and I looked over her x-rays and whatnot, and she had terrible spine problems, and both the cervical, thoracic, and lumbar spine, the vertebral bodies and whatnot. And I thought there's got to be some relationship between all of that bony pathology and the fact that she has amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is a disease of the spinal cord. And yet all the neurologists and orthopedic surgeons and everything said, no, I'm totally wrong, and there is no relationship because there's no compression of the cervical or cord or the thoracic cord. There has to be some kind of compression of the cord for it to be causing some kind of problem. Mm-hmm. And since there's no compression, then she didn't have to worry about all these other problems with her vertebral column. And I put it aside because they were the experts and this is my first case. And so just kind of kept that thought in my mind. And so
that was conventional wisdom at that
conventional
time.
Wisdom. It still is. And so I'm trying to bring you all up to where I'm at now historically, but it may take some time.
We have time.
We've got time.
Love it.
Sure.
But over years, I kept seeing the same kind of pattern with a lot of people with injuries to the neck and former injuries to the neck. And everybody knows when they start studying amyotrophic lateral sclerosis that it's often in those people who've played soccer or football or some kind of sports.
Really?
It's more males than females. And And the females that you talk to, they've had car accidents or some kind of trauma to their cervical spine. Mm. And so I kind of started studying that. And then one time a few years ago, a chiropractor and I got together. We were talking about things, and we were discussing how we could work together. And I said, well, you know, and we got to talking about what I can do with stem cells, because I've been working on stem cells for the last 15 years, and I've done like 7,000 cases and bone marrow and umbilical cord and fat and you name it. I've pretty much studied it and used them for a variety of things. So I'm pretty much an expert on stem cells. And so he has asked me what I could do to help people with spinal injuries and spinal disc problems. And we got to talking about that and discussed it. And I started studying it a little bit, and it comes out that pain in the spine, anywhere in the spine, either in the vertebral bodies or the disc or in the muscles or the fat even, causes a production of certain cytokines called tumor necrosis factor and gamma interferon, which have a detrimental effect on the brain and the spinal cord. So these cytokines are elevated in most all of the neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and ALS. And so that was interesting. I said, well, there's maybe some relationship between all of this. And so I started studying it more and more, and so I kind of just applied that knowledge as I was going along to study all the patients that I was dealing with, because most of them are neurological cases. So some of the cases with cerebral palsy would have elevated levels and all this kind of thing. And
so the cytokines are being raised because of a traumatic sort of injury?
Yeah, for some reason the body responds to an injury by production of these cytokines. Mm. And it's the actual tissue, the fat cell, the muscle cell, connected to whatever, these cells actually, and then the white blood cells, the lymphocytes and monocytes and all those, they all produce these kinds of cytokines.
Wow.
So so that was interesting, and especially because there are certain drugs that can be used for it, like Enbrel, which is etanercept, and there's a fellow that is promoting the use of etanercept by injection in the back of the neck for treatment of all kinds of conditions, and he's recently been under fire for his exaggerated claims, which I believe are exaggerated.
What is he saying?
Well, he's saying that, you know, you take a shot of this stuff and you're remarkably improved. Mm. And he doesn't promise it, but there's an implication. And each
doing
shot
this for neurological issues, same
stuff
like
you're stroke doing. And backache, back pain. And
is that a pharmaceutical, what
yeah,
he's done?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's Enbrel. And it's an expensive treatment. But so anyway, there's treatments for it. And so that became interesting. And I started studying it with ALS. And then I found with ALS that there's other problems that were associated. And so I found, first of all, that if you look at the literature, there's a whole bunch of literature that says that spinal column problems in the cervical spine especially are related to ALS, as compared to what is generally touted. And every time you pick up a review article, they don't mention those things. But if
they
you
don't
start,
mention that.
You know, start looking at it carefully and look at all the papers, it's quite a pile of papers.
Wow.
And so I said, well, there's all these papers that say that, and I'm seeing it too, so let me just start doing cervical spine CAT scans on everybody. So I started doing that just to see what's going on. And right now we found that close to 95% of all ALS patients that are spontaneous have cervical spinal neuroforaminal stenosis, which means that the spinal nerve, a spinal nerve or more than one spinal nerve in the cervical spine is being compressed by this former injury. So they have an injury, they were a football player, they had a soccer player, they injured their neck. That caused then the development of the scar tissue and granulomatous tissue and calcification and degeneration of the area, and that causes compression of a spinal nerve. Now that's okay because they're functioning and they don't have any symptoms. And then one day they twist their neck, they hurt themselves, they fall down, they get into a car accident, something happens and that same area is re-injured. And the scar tissue that's formed, I believe, is, you know, like scar tissue, when you rip it, it tears. Uh-huh. And so it tears, and that causes more inflammation. That generates this tumor necrosis factor, gamma interferon. And it attracts monocytes, which are phagocytic cells from the bloodstream, to come there and try to solve that area.
So are these parts, the cytokines are also created during this time too?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So normally this person I'm talking about now, person who's had a car accident in the past or a football player or whatever, they hurt their neck. It's healed. You know, in general, they function okay. They don't have symptoms. Sometimes they have pain, but not very often, maybe 10% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so nobody ever thinks that the spine is really a problem. The patient starts developing weakness in that arm or whatever. They go from one doctor to another and another. And finally, doctors all say, well, that's what it is. It's ALS. And the doctors never really ask carefully about the patient as to when they had their last accident. And usually it's within the year. Sometimes it's within a day or two of when they develop the symptoms. So they can have an injury. They re-injure their neck. They say, oh, God, I twisted my neck. It hurt like crazy for 24 hours. And then 2 days later, I developed this weakness in the right arm. Hmm. And when you do then the cervical spine CAT scans, you'll find that the spinal stenosis is on the right side at C4, 5, 5, 6, something like that.
This is upper cervical issues a lot of times.
Yeah, it's all upper cervical, mm-hmm. And so that all of this stuff starts to become more and more related. I've had one case where they had paralysis on the right side, but this neurofibromatous stenosis is on the left, and so you don't know for sure, but they had moderate on the right, so it could have been that the injury itself was more on the right, but on the x-ray it looked more on the left. So that's
most of the time it occurs on the same side.
Most always, it's always on the same
when
side.
When you're talking about this, I'm thinking Muhammad Ali with all those, I'm sure he had whiplash from mm-hmm, the punches mm-hmm, and things mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah, well, Parkinson's and ALS are very much related because of these same things. And then we kind of morph into what else can be causing it, because it's not just that. You have to have other things to have this happen rather than, sort of like the perfect storm of disease is what it is. And so it's all these factors that you have to consider. And if you want to produce ALS, you do this. And one of the things you have to do is eat a lot of junk food and sugar and have your immune system somewhat suppress and make sure that you get a yeast infestation in your intestinal tract. And once you get a candida infection in your gut, and say they take antibiotics, anybody who takes antibiotics for any kind of long period of time is going to have a tendency to develop a yeast infestation of their intestinal tract, which oftentimes is not symptomatic at all. And if you don't have any symptoms, then you don't have it, right?
Yeah. Or a lot of people may have it, and it's to such a low degree that it's not affecting them.
But
how does that affect the cytokines in the upper cervical?
Well, let me just get into that. It's quite a complicated story. It's simple also. And so what happens is that, I'll give you an example. I had a patient, she's currently not really a patient, but a friend of mine who's a physician assistant had a new baby, and the baby was fine, but she developed She developed an upper respiratory tract infection and took antibiotics for that, but she was nursing. And the baby then, as soon as she was finishing up the antibiotics, during that time, the baby developed colic.
Which is pretty normal.
Yeah, you would think. But, remember this. This is, she took antibiotics, was nursing, and the antibiotics are carried to the baby. Okay. So the baby's getting antibiotics, whether or not the baby wants it or not. And the baby's in this first month after delivery, so it's immunologically compromised to start with. And babies tend to have yeast anyway. And then this baby developed colic. And so this is a sign of yeast infestation, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And so then 2 months later, then the baby developed Kawasaki's disease. And Kawasaki's disease is an inflammatory vasculitis of the entire body. And it's been thought to be totally unknown as to the etiology, but I suggested to the mom that this was caused by candida and yeast infestation of the baby in combination with then what are called super antigens, bacteria like staph and strep that have certain antigens that are very strong, and the combination of those strong antigens and the fact that there's candida there, both of which are sitting on the mucosal surface of the intestinal tract, causes inflammation of the gut wall, and these bacterial products can get into the body. Once they get into the body, they stimulate the inflammatory processes and stimulate these they're called toll-like receptors, and these all then create this the cytokine storm, and the cytokine storm is then what causes the Kawasaki's. And so after I told her that, I said, well, we're going to do this and this, but the child is very, very ill and had to be hospitalized. And the doctors at the hospital here just don't understand that kind of stuff, and they don't keep up. They're too busy to keep up.
So
I'm trying to not be that busy, so I can't keep up.
Yeah, I know it's a challenge.
Yeah, it is a challenge. And so anyway, so I told the mom about the candida and all that, and how she should be. So I started her on antifungals and all that. So she was all for that, but the doctors there at the hospital said, nah, it can't be. Well, 2 weeks after I suggested it out of Japan, they came a big study. it shows, in fact, reality, Kawasaki's is Candida. And so, you know, here I was, I was 2 weeks ahead, and I didn't have to spend two, it was like a $500,000 study they did over there. So I just did it from just pure practical just
instinct,
sense, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, it happens in babies, it happens in older people, it happens in all of us. And so that, but in general, most of us don't have problems with it because our immune system is strong enough and healthy enough to help keep it at bay. But it oftentimes winds up in this, I don't know if it's kosher anymore to say a Mexican standoff.
Everything's PC these days.
Everything is so. Yeah. I can't say anything. Yeah. I say Donald Trump told me to say that.
Oh, man.
So we have this standoff in the gut where the body's trying to attack these bugs that are trying to get in. And so the body develops all these antibodies, and you can measure these antibodies. They're anti-candida antibodies, anti-saccharomyces antibodies, and there's a what's called an inflammatory irritable or inflammatory bowel disease panel measures a whole bunch of these kinds of antibodies too. And you measure all those, and most of these patients with ALS have those antibodies. So they have all these antibodies that say that they've got a yeast infestation.
Okay.
Then you do a stool test on them, and they've got stool that has got yeast in it.
Okay.
And then you do a urine organic acid metabolite study, and they have yeast metabolites
in the urine.
In the urine. And there's a quite high percentage. So we have, first we have cervical stenosis, we have recent injury, we have correlation between the recent injury and the paralysis, we've got gut mucosal irritation, we've got gut bacteria, which are Clostridia usually, which are have neurotoxic activities, and there's a few others that are. There's frankly hundreds of neurotoxins, and any of those probably can work with the yeast to cause this problem. But in any case, the monocytes, which are phagocytic cells that are floating in the blood, they go to the gut and try to help protect that and fix that. Now, the monocytes make what is called superoxide dismutase.
Okay.
And superoxide dismutase is an enzyme that breaks down superoxide, which is the bugs there, the bacteria and the yeast produce to cause the colitis or inflammation in the gut.
Okay.
Now, usually this colitis and inflammation is in the terminal ileum, in the cecum area, and that's a very strange area. It's like the no man's land of the body because nobody really studied it. It's hard to study. It's,
where is this? In the gut?
Where the appendix is.
Okay.
On the right-hand lower quadrant. There's the small intestine joins into the large intestine right there.
Uh-huh.
And at the very end of the small bowel, the small intestine, that area is called the cecum or ileum, terminal ileum. And that is got a totally different morphology and structure than the rest of the small intestine or the large intestine. And it acts like a balloon, which is very strange. And I mean, it's not strange. It's really, if you stop and think about it, it's really practical. And the body has got some great wisdom there because what happens normally for all of us is that we eat our food. And first of all, if you eat food that is not digested well, it goes down the chute and is going into the large bowel. Well, the body would like to know what is not being digested and what are we having trouble with. And so it analyzes that there and picks out the things that are not being digested, absorbs those and starts making antibodies to those. And will, if you have a lot of that kind of one thing, let's say wheat is not being absorbed,
right,
because you have gluten and neuropathy or something, the wheat gets down there, and then at that point it's still raw and intact and it can be absorbed. And because this is the only place in the body where the gut has a lot of lymphatics. And so the lymphatics are there, the blood is there, it's a very thin wall so that it can be absorbed well. And so you have a site in the body where all these raw materials can be looked at and analyzed and made antibodies to. And so this is just a natural way, all of us. Now, another thing it does is that it acts as a safety valve. So when your large intestine has a lot of this undigested food get there, the bacteria start to make gas.
Mm-hmm.
And there's methane and hydrogen and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And these gases can build up, and usually then you pass gas and say, excuse me, or you hold it and then tell yourself that it's okay because it doesn't come out, and so it's okay, and you forget about it. And what happens, though, there is that instead of going out through the rectum, it stays in the body and goes up into the small intestine. Well, you can't have gas going up in the small intestine from the large bowel because that gas has got bacteria in it that's going to cause a bacterial overgrowth in the small bowel, so that then causes troubles. And so you don't want that.
Wow.
And the body says, forget that.
Yeah.
And so this terminal ileum then acts like a balloon, and it swells up when there comes gas into that part from the large bowel. The large bowel has this, there's an ileocecal valve there, mm-hmm. and that, even though it's tight and all that, it cannot keep gas that's under pressure from coming through from the large bowel into the small bowel. And so here comes gas, and what is the body going to do with it? Well, the ileum is there, and it's like a balloon. It just it swells up, and then that helps take the pressure off the gas, so that the gas doesn't go up into the small bowel, and you don't get any problems there. Mm-hmm. So that's a very nice thing to have as mm-hmm. far as the safety issue is concerned.
Yeah.
Well, in this case, though, you have that area is infested with this yeast because it also is the area of the body that has the least amount of oxygen in any part of the intestinal tract that has the least amount of oxygen. And so anaerobic bacteria and yeast grow there quite well.
Interesting.
And so you have this problem of kind of like a cesspool of junk right there. And blood is not, there is blood there to take food away, but not a lot of blood there to nourish and fight things.
Okay.
So it's not like the small bowel and the large bowel where there's a lot more structure and a lot more tissue. So in any case, there's this, I think in general, that's where the war is. And the same area where Crohn's disease is. So many of the markers for Crohn's disease and ALS are similar in terms of the antifungal antibodies and whatnot. Now we have this situation where monocytes going into the terminal ileum to fight the superoxide anion, which is being produced by these bugs, and that causes the colitis or Crohn's disease. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now they have this monocyte making superoxide dismutase to help detoxify that. Well, now the monocytes say, wait a second, we got way too much superoxide here. We got to make more superoxide dismutase. So it makes a lot more superoxide dismutase. And as it does that, it also becomes activated, which means that it's become very active metabolically, and it starts to do all kinds of things in terms of taking up these toxins from the gut. And there's more toxins than just the yeast toxins, but there's a lot of toxins from these bacteria. Some of these are called lipopolysaccharides and endotoxins, and they then poison the monocyte, and they cause what is called oxidative stress in the monocyte. Well, now, that oxidative stress causes a change in the output of the superoxide dismutase. Normally, the superoxide dismutase, when it's produced, is produced as a single strand and mm-hmm. it's dumped into what's called the endoplasmic reticulum, which is like a little channel or river that runs from the cytoplasm to the outside of the cell. Mm-hmm. And this endoplasmic reticulum is like the Cuyahoga River back in the 70s when it caught on fire. It's full of junk at this point. When you have all these endotoxins and all this junk coming in, this endoplasmic reticulum becomes full of junk. And so now the body, the monocyte produces a superoxide dismutase, but it's in what's called an unfolded type of strand, and it gets in there, and it's supposed to be then correctly folded into proper position and then excreted out of the body or out of the monocyte, and then once it's excreted, it's able to detoxify the superoxide and protect the body from this inflammatory stress reaction. Anyway, so here the endoplasmic reticulum is under oxidative stress, mm-hmm. sort of like a rusting kind of thing, and the river is full of junk, and so these little strands cannot fold properly, and so they just get stuck. So the monocyte becomes stuck with these unfolded superoxide dismutase molecules and full of junk like endotoxins and the yeast particles and the bacterial particles, and then it moves out of that gut wall and goes into circulation, and then it says, whoa, look at this, something else to do, and because it's already activated and fighting and trying to kill all this stuff, it's primed to kill everything, mm-hmm. and so here comes one more thing to kill, and it happens to see your neck, which has been just recently injured, and so there it goes, pops in there, and with that it jumps into the spinal nerve injury, and because of the injury, that allows entry from the blood into the cerebrospinal fluid. The monocyte can go in there and dump these misfolded, unfolded, improperly folded superoxide dismutase molecules, the endotoxins, and these other toxins right into the cord. And this is what causes the inflammatory processes and the SOD that is there. This is unfolded, but it's misfolded, and now it can actually replicate like a prion can. And uh-huh. so you have then a situation where even a few monocytes can trigger this whole thing, and so that you can have reactions tomorrow after the injury, or the neck injury, or you can have a response 6 months later, because it may take 6 months for these few, just because there's just a few monocytes get in there and just a few of these misfolded SOD molecules start in replicating, and it takes time for them to replicate enough to cause enough damage to start seeing the effects.
How long
of the
does
weakness.
That take?
Like I say, it can take up to a year. Mm-hmm. And so you check to see if they've had any, if they can remember. Now, sometimes people cannot remember, but in general, I'd say probably 80% of the time, when before, when you first ask them, they cannot remember anything about mm-hmm. having any injury whatsoever. That's about most everybody.
Really?
And then if you sit down and say, okay, now I know you can't remember right now, but I want you to think about it. What did you have? Just think, did you have any car accidents? Did you have this? Did you have that? And just go through it and spend a, 15, 20 minutes. And most of the time you come up with something that says, oh yeah, I did have this and that.
And so that would just be even minor neck injuries?
It can be just a minor neck injury, because it doesn't take much to cause that fibrosis that's occurred around that spinal nerve to be torn. And so it's just, how much does it take to tear a little bit of scar tissue?
Not much,
you see. And so you have to have this combination of the proper chronic infestation of the gut with all these things. You have to have the monocytes being active. You have to have the cervical problem beforehand. Mm-hmm. You've had the injury beforehand, and now you have to have a repeat injury. You put it all together, you start having ALS. And so, now once you get it, it's going to keep on going as long as your gut keeps being infected, as long as you keep pumping monocytes in, and as long as you keep injuring your neck. Like if you're a motorcyclist, you keep riding your motorcycle, you're doomed no matter what.
Why? Because
you keep injuring it.
See?
So if you keep injuring your neck, I can't help you, nor anybody else can. I had one patient I put into remission, and I said, you cannot go riding motorcycles. I love motorcycles. Mm. I can't live without them. Well, he lived another 3 months then, because he went right back to riding motorcycles. I guess it was a little longer that he lived, but the point was that he was not about to listen.
Right.
People don't like to change.
So how does this translate to the brain when the cytokines and all this stuff and happens in the neck? How does this translate to going into the brain?
Well, it has to be what's called a cerebral spinal fluid blood barrier break.
Okay.
Now that can occur for a variety of reasons. I've seen it once or twice in a patient who had small strokes in the basal ganglia and the medulla oblongata.
Uh-huh.
When you have a small strokes and there's a damage to the blood-brain barrier, then you can have these bugs can get in through that, and that can cause it. Now, another thing I've seen is sinus infestations can cause that, because there's connections between the sinus and the brain. Through the nose, you have the cribriform plate and the olfactory nerves that connect with the brain. And then we have dental abscesses I've seen where it contributes to the whole process. So now, is it the cause? I'm not so sure that each one of those is the ultimate cause. It could be that these things are contributing factors because often, another one is Helicobacter pylori, gastritis, and that's this infection of the stomach causes chronic gastritis. And those people, when you find that they have it and you treat them, they get better. So if you can identify these other infections in the body and treat them, oftentimes the person will get better just from that alone without addressing these other issues. But I think you have to look at all these other issues. Now, another issue we haven't talked about is heavy metals. And mercury. Mercury is probably number one, but at least I kind of think so. My we're just reviewing the data, and lead is right up there too. So between lead and mercury, there's a study back in 1968, I think. ALS was associated with lead poisoning in South Dakota in 4 cases. That was the first report of that. And since then, there hasn't been too much evidence of that. But again, the doctors that we're dealing with here are neurologists who are good at diagnosing that you've got a long corticospinal tract injury or something strange that you have never heard of, and it really means nothing in terms of your treatment, and instead of looking at things that can be treated. I'm a practical guy. I look at what can we find that we can treat. Mm-hmm. And so it's just like Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is a condition that is quite complicated and a mysterious disease for most people and most doctors.
Kate's family was just telling her the other day that it runs in the family and there's nothing they can do about it.
And it's absolutely generational.
Yeah, it's absolutely generational.
Well, what do you think about that?
Well, I think there's a lot of BS in this world. It may be that there's some predilection that you have. You could have what's called an apolipoprotein E4 problem, and that makes you more susceptible to having like cholesterol cause degeneration of your brain. There's about 100 different conditions that simulate or look like Alzheimer's. And back in 1980, 2008, there's a magazine article in Drugs, it's called. Drugs was the journal. And in that journal article, they reviewed Alzheimer's and how many were correctly diagnosed. And it was only 55% were correctly diagnosed by all the neurologists.
What?
And so you're talking about a whole bunch of misdiagnoses. And now, I think the diagnostic techniques and abilities have progressed since then because of our PET scans and our MRIs and all that. But we still have a fair amount of misdiagnosis. Now, vascular dementia is a very common problem that, you know, back in 1968 again, there was a guy, where was he? He was at University of, he was at the VA in Indiana, I believe. Anyway, his name slips my mind. He was a German neuropathologist who happened to get out of Germany at the, you know, in the time of Hitler, and came to the United States and took up residency here. And so he was a very good neuropathologist. And he came up with the idea that, he did a bunch of autopsies on vets, and he diagnosed Alzheimer's in a great majority of them, and he published a paper on it. And because of that paper, the world changed its tune, because before that, it was all this dementia was called vascular dementia. Mm-hmm. And at that time, all the doctors, that's all they knew. And now here's this neuropathologists say, no, we have to re-examine all this. And most of the stuff could be Alzheimer's. And so his paper kind of reset the whole tone of what the neurologists were diagnosing. And so since then, there's been a lot more Alzheimer's diagnosed than vascular dementia. Mm-hmm. And vascular dementia has kind of fallen by the wayside. But if you look at the literature on Alzheimer's, about 70% of all Alzheimer's is due to some degree of vascular disease. One third of it is vascular disease. And another third is somewhat moderate amount of vascular disease, and a third is some degree, so a little bit, and then there's one third, or no, that's, I got, that's one third, so two thirds.
It's a lot of thirds.
There's too many thirds in here. So it's like 33% is vascular, total vascular, and you can treat that now, and then about 66% total has some vascular degree, and there's about a third there that are just unknown.
Okay.
Now, those unknowns are maybe that apolipoprotein E4 problem and all these other things, because there's a lot of different things that can cause this situation. In any case, I published, I did a video in 1985 about this, and talking about use of chelation, because chelation is a way of cleaning out the arteries and helping repair the arteries. And I found that about 60% of my patients with Alzheimer's were improving quite significantly by using chelation.
You said 60%.
60%, yeah. And so it's close to that 66% of statistics. Anyway, the Alzheimer's Association just went nuts on me, because I was saying, well, I've got something that has been shown to cure people who have been diagnosed.
Did you use the C word?
Yeah, because...
I love it.
Because, I don't know, but they were helped. Maybe I said helped. I don't know. I've always been cautious about using the C word.
Yeah.
But in any case, I said, let's just say I said helped. Yeah. So 60% of patients with Alzheimer's I said 60% of patients who have been diagnosed as having Alzheimer's. Now, if you remember, I said 55% were misdiagnosed as having Alzheimer's. So it's basically, I'm saying that I'm treating the ones that are misdiagnosed.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm not doing anything wrong.
I'm not doing anything wrong. Well, they didn't want to hear that, because that's too complicated for their little brains. Mm-hmm. So they weren't going to listen to the facts. So they just were going to attack. So I said, well, I'm not going to stand for that. I'm not going to run my business being attacked all the time by the Alzheimer's Association. Yeah. So I kind of backed away from treating Alzheimer's, because, you know, it's politically unwise. And a lot of times you have things that, you know, are true, but the politics are so much that people have to suffer because you have politics involved.
I wanted to ask you about this. Have you, I know you must have had lots of issues with this whole political side of what you do. How are you able to do this? Because a lot of times people think, you know, doctors like you need to be in Mexico or Canada, things like that. How have you been able to stay doing what you're doing?
Well, one of the things I learned some years ago when I first started doing hyperbaric oxygen for stroke. Now, that was back in, 91? And in 1991, I had a patient, Dorothy Conforti. Dorothy was, she was like 72, and advanced arteriosclerotic cerebrovascular and cardiovascular disease, and she wasn't about to change her life. And I told her she had to change her lifestyle, she had to change her diet, she had to do this and that. And she basically said, "Nope. Sorry, but
I'm 72.
I'm 72.
I'm okay.
I'm okay. I'm okay doing what I'm doing.
I'm not okay, but you know.
You know, so.
Motorcycles and vodka.
So she went home and kept on doing what. 3 months later, her daughter calls me and said, "We're at the hospital, and mom had a stroke, and what are we going to do?" And I said, "Well, let's call an ambulance and sign her out against medical advice and bring her over to me." Oh. And she was in a coma at the time.
She was in a coma. Yeah. At her home?
No, at the hospital. They were going to put her in intensive care. And so this is like grab some parts of my body and hang on.
Yeah, goodness. Jeez.
So here she comes in the ambulance, just gorked out basically. And we have to take four of us to pick her up and put her into our hyperbaric oxygen chamber. You know, a hyperbaric oxygen is a chamber under pressure with oxygen, forces oxygen into the brain. It helps resolve some of this damage because a stroke is a lack of oxygen to the brain. So we got in there, and I put an attendant in with her and to make sure that she didn't choke or swallow or, you know, aspirate.
Okay.
And so we kept her safe and gave her oxygen for an hour, hyperbaric oxygen. And after an hour, I was hoping she was going to be cured. But, in fact, she was no better at all. And so I'm saying to myself, "You just bought the farm, baby. You're going to be.
You just went all in.
I just went all in, and yeah. If I don't fix this one up, I'm going to lose my license. I'm going to go to jail.
She called your bluff.
So I happened to have a very good kitchen at the time, which means in medical grade, I was fully loaded with all of the ingredients that I needed to help her, and so I pulled out a whole poopera, if you will, of ingredients, antioxidants, and things like mannitol and chelation and magnesium and catalase and superoxide dismutase and et cetera, et cetera.
So at this point, she's in the chamber. She's been there for an hour.
Yeah, and I've taken her out, and I started her on this IV of material that I've come up with.
And she wasn't awake yet or anything?
No, she's just kind of laying there.
Still just
she's sleeping.
Yeah,
she's sleeping,
yes. And I put... what's called a pulse magnetic field therapy on the back of her head to increase circulation to her head.
Okay.
And so I ran this IV with chelation, DMSO, magnesium, mannitol, etc., into her for 3 hours, and with this pulse magnetic therapy, put her back in the chamber, did another hour, and this time she got better. Then I said, "Well, she's getting better, so let's keep doing it." So I did the same thing over and over again every 4 hours around the clock. And now she came in at about, what time was it she came in? I think about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. She had had the stroke at about 7 in the morning, so she was at my office about 6 hours after she'd had the stroke. And so by the next morning at 10 o'clock, we kept doing this all night. By 10 o'clock the next morning, she walked out of my clinic by herself. And at that point, I said, "Well, hyperbaric," and that was so she's getting hyperbaric and all this. And I said, "Well, hyperbaric oxygen has got, and with this combination is one.
One heck of a combination.
You know, to this day, nobody's ever replicated that at all. And, never probably will because...
the resources involved.
Yeah, because it cost... that was a pretty expensive little day.
I imagine.
But compared to sending her home with then doing physical therapy and occupational therapy for the next 3 years and suffering and misery and not being able to function ever again, I thought it was quite well worth it.
Wow.
Was time of the essence?
Yes. You have to get to that person to do that kind of get that kind of result. You have to have them within the first 24 hours.
I was wondering.
Otherwise, you just don't do it. The brain just... It's just for some reason, 24 hours is
the cutoff.
I've seen them improve at 30 hours. That's the max. But
30 hours.
Yeah, but
people got to know. They got to act quick. Yeah.
I just need to take a quick break. We're still going to be live on the show here, but let me just change our batteries. This is too good. I don't want to miss any of this.
You know, obviously, it sounds like a very not well known kind of treatment you can do. But I always think for people who are dealing with those kinds of injuries and wait 2 months and then they find out about something like this. I always wondered if there's hope for people like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, how does that work?
There is hope. For, you know, you can't repair somebody. At least I haven't found that you can repair a person who's had an injury 10, 15 years ago to the degree that you can if you get them right away. So in other words, there's a much better chance of having much more significant improvement the sooner you can get to treating them. But even if you wait for a long time, you can still see improvement. Now, for example, the best case I've got that is an example of that is a fellow who is 62, and he had evidence of a stroke, basically a traumatic brain injury. He had a car accident when he was 12. So at 12 years of age, he has a car accident, and he developed such a brain injury he couldn't speak very well, and he has to limp, and so his right arm doesn't work, his leg doesn't work well, and he's gone through his life now since 12 through 62 like this. And he is brought in to the office by his 85-year-old mother, who happens to be a psychologist, and says, you know, I'm getting a little old, and I've got some money stashed away, and I'd like to treat my son with stem cells. And I said, are you kidding me? Are you crazy? That is nuts. I mean, who would ever think 50 years out we're going to get anywhere with this guy with stem cells? And she says, yeah, I know it sounds impossible, but I have faith.
So, that's so cool.
So I want to do it anyway. I said, well, it just allows you to know that I can do it, but I can't sure tell you that it's going to work. So that's okay. I just want to do it. I said, okay, well, we'll do it. So I gave him stem cells, and within 6 weeks, he was like good 50% better. Good 50%. His speech had improved.
Within how long?
Six weeks.
And how often was he going?
Just once. I just gave him one shot of stem cells.
You're kidding me.
No.
Now, for people that don't understand about stem cells, there's different places where you can get stem cells, like you mentioned earlier. And there are specific protocols, right? What you can do to them and not do to them because we're in the United States. And is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, there's certain rules and regulations that the FDA says you have to do. And mostly it revolves around calling it a drug.
Okay.
And so, and this brings me back to what I started talking about was the fact that some years ago I started doing this hyperbaric oxygen and I started promoting it for the treatment of stroke. And so the FDA came down on me and closed me down because I was calling oxygen a drug for the treatment of stroke, and that was an unproven claim. And therefore, it was an unproven drug claim, and therefore, I was breaking the law. So here's a safe, natural substance, just oxygen, and I'm saying it helps somebody with stroke that nobody else has been able to figure out how to do anything with, and to do a clinical trial to prove it was going to cost, you know, $500 million. Yeah. There's no way that anybody's going to do that because there's no drug money involved. There's no money involved. So who's going to do that?
You know what the outcome would be.
And, first of all, you can't have it done because there's just nobody's going to spend that kind of money.
Right.
So anyway, you wind up doing what the FDA says because they're the FDA.
So what did they do in terms of coming
down? They came in and they raided me, and they put embargo notifications on all my chambers. I'm the only person in the country that's ever been embargoed.
You're kidding.
And whatever that means. And
yeah, that's bizarre.
Big seals on them and said that if I broke those seals, then they're going to take them out in the parking lot and cut them into little pieces. And each one cost, $100,000+.
Yeah,
so
expensive.
They were talking about $700,000 worth of equipment they were going to destroy.
So they said this to you or through paperwork?
No, they just told me.
Oh my God.
Now the FDA was totally wrong in what they did. They were breaking the law, but they don't care.
No,
see,
no.
See, they don't care. People don't understand that the FDA and the government really they've got all these rules and regulations, but they don't pay attention to them.
Yeah.
If they don't want to, they'll just come in and stomp on you.
Yeah.
And tear your
gizzard
out. Apart.
Yeah.
Tear your gizzard out.
Yeah, they'll do that
and,
too.
Then they tell you, well, sue us. And you have to sue them. And you have to sue them, and that's what I did. I had to sue them. And so I sued them. That cost $100,000 right there. And with a lawsuit, they looked at all the paperwork, and I had a lot more evidence that I was right and they were wrong. And so they backed off and let me go back into practice.
But that's how you're able to start using the tanks again.
Yeah, so I started back in, and they said the only thing was that they didn't want us to do was, or me to do, was promote it as a drug. And I couldn't make any claims. And my attorney said, forget that, whatever they tell you.
just
go ahead and advertise like you've been, and if they come after you again, we'll go to court again. And so I said, okay. And so I went ahead and continued on with that. So I did.
So what year was that?
That was 1994, I think.
1994.
Yeah. In fact, it was the first. That was in September, I think it was, of 94. When, and this is an interesting coincidence. Not if it's coincidence or planned.
Right.
Was that the September of 94 was when the TPA, the tissue plasminogen activator, the drug for stroke, was given the approval by the FDA. So as of that date, September 1st or so, that drug was open for use in the country for acute stroke. And I came out saying hyperbaric oxygen does wonders for acute stroke.
And so your thing was a little bit after that, a few weeks later kind of thing?
Yeah, it was three weeks later was when they rated me. So
it seems too coincidental, doesn't
it? It does, doesn't it?
It's a little bit.
And then we had the president of the National Stroke Association who filed affidavits saying that what I was doing was quackery. And turned out that when we started, his name was Fletcher McDowell. He was head of the Department of Rehabilitation in New York and had 350 papers on physical medicine, physical therapy, because he's a physical therapist in stroke rehabilitation. And it turned out that he had the year before gone to China and had a lecture tour with another doctor, a friend of mine, Richard Neubauer. And Richard Neubauer was kind of the first one ever to do hyperbaric oxygen for stroke. And he had a lot of cases that were just truly remarkable, mm-hmm. and that's how I got involved with it. And
is he still practicing?
No, he's gone now. He's got up there.
Okay.
And so anyway, he and this guy Fletcher McDowell went to China, and all of the people there, all the doctors, just clamored to hear more from Neubauer and hyperbaric, because it was something that they could do. It didn't hurt anybody and it was effective and all that. So they were bombarding him with interest, and he got all kinds of newspaper stuff going, and he got a lot of pats on the back, and Fletcher McDowell with all his papers and everything just was kind of shoved aside, and he was the president of the National Stroke Association.
Yeah, so he's upset. So
embargo.
I know, right?
He got very upset.
Embargo him.
So he got very upset with the whole concept of hyperbaric, and so when the state of California asked him to make a decision the next year about hyperbaric, he made up and confabulated a bunch of falsehoods about what I was doing, and so that was sad, but it was politically, again, the National Stroke Association was paid by the pharmaceutical industry, mm-hmm. so you're talking about the pharmaceutical industry who is into drugs, and he's the drug guy, he's pushing that whole thing. So
it's interesting. I look at all these things, the pink ribbon for the breast cancer, and all of these things are, for how long are we going to be raising awareness to these things? I mean, as far as I know, everyone knows what breast cancer is. We don't need any more awareness to these things.
Yeah.
It's not as if it's something we don't know about.
Right. Well, let's look at the bucket challenge too.
I was going to ask you about that.
Where'd the money go? It went into research for familial ALS. Well, familial ALS is 10% of the total, if that. And out of that, there's all these mutations. There's hundreds of mutations right now, more than 100 at least, of mutations of genes that are associated with that particular thing. Well, that's not 90% of all the cases. I'm talking about the 90%. I think what I've discovered is the cause of 90% of ALS patients. Mm-hmm. And now I've finished up the ALS story. If you go back, what I've said about the fungus and everything, I've said that I've identified in most cases fungal metabolites or fungus in the yeast in the stool and in mm-hmm. the urine, and antibodies to it in the blood. Now, about a month ago now, in Spain, there was a study that was published. 62 patients of ALS patients who died had autopsies, and they analyzed their brains and cerebral spinal fluid and cords, and 62 out of 62 had yeast metabolites in their body, in their brain and cord. So that's 100% of all ALS patients have fungus in their brain and cord. Now, the answer to that is by the neurologist said, well, who cares? And it doesn't prove anything. And it could be just so they were dying anyway, so that's why they got it.
That's interesting.
And they have all these excuses, sort of like the cardiologist had for years about cholesterol.
Right.
And mm-hmm. cholesterol, I remember when I started our lab tests back and I started practicing in this area in 1978. And at that time, whatever it was, the lab, the big labs, I always use the great big labs and because they're reliable generally. Anyway, their cholesterol levels for normal were 160 to 350. And I'm trying to tell everybody that, and I'm treating cardiac disease patients, heart disease, and I'm doing chelation and all this. And I'm trying to tell my patients, you know, you've got coronary artery disease. You've got to get your cholesterol down below 160. And they say, why? Look at the lab test. It says I'm normal up to 340, like my 350. So, you know, and I had a big argument all the time. Yeah. Every day it was like that, a big argument about who's right.
Yeah.
And trying to convince the patient when the labs kept saying that it was correct. And the cardiologist said the same thing. And they refused to believe. And tell, they would say, no, that you can't reverse cardiac disease with a diet or lowering cholesterol. And that was when the days of Pritikin, you know, Pritikin came out with his book, Live Longer Now, in 1977. And so I kind of lived with that. I was in the process of writing a book like that before his came out. Uh-huh. He was ahead. Because I'm always, you know, it's always fun to say that I was doing that, but I was, but, you know, it comes down to that there's only so much time in a man's life.
I know, right?
And so you say, okay, I'm writing this book, but I don't have time to do it all because I'm not doing that full time. I'm also, at that time, I was a resident in pathology at the University of Oregon. And so I have to do my pathology stuff too. So, and it's not like I'm doing full time cardiac rehab at the time. So that was why Pritikin, though, had a reason. He had his own problems and he took care of himself by it and all that. So he did great and he did a lot of good for a lot of people. But since when he died, then that whole kind of push, you know, if one person can make such a difference in the world, and he was making quite a difference in the world, and you stop and think about people who made differences and you know, just put them on your fingers, and there's only a few that really make a big difference.
A big difference, right.
And have an influence all of our lives. And I think Pritikin was one, and if he would have been able to, some kind of a motion, or some kind of a company or something that would keep his ideas going, it still would be much more effective in terms of cardiac rehab, because we still, now today, all we have, now like in 93, when Mevacor came out, which is our first drug for lowering cholesterol. At that time, now before that, the doctors all said it's a bunch of hooey, that we cannot lower cholesterol, we're not going to do it, we can't do it, and all that. And the reason why is because it took time. It takes time to sit down and say, okay, now we're going to go over your diet. Now, what do you have for breakfast? Oh, you have milk. What kind of milk? That's it. 1%, 2%, or whole milk. Okay, well, you can't have any of that. You have to have 0%, or you have to go to soy. Who likes soy, right? And then you have to, or rice milk, or this or that. Okay, now how about this? How about that? And you have to go through it. And then you have to come bring them back the next week and say, okay, now how are you doing?
Are you sticking with it?
Are you sticking with it? And then you have to convince them over and over again to stay on the program. And it's a bunch of, you don't get paid for that. There's no money in it.
Yeah.
You know, I had an example of that. I gave a 2-hour lecture once with a group of doctors up and down the coast. I invited everybody from San Diego to LA, and all nutritional kind of people, cardiologists, whatnot. One of the guys was my local cardiologist here. And after 2 hours of lecturing about how you can reverse heart disease by diet and all these different supplements and things and chelation, I said, well, what do you think, George? And George looked at me and said, well, that's all very interesting, but I can't afford to know any of it. And that
can't afford to know anything.
Yeah, because it costs him money to sit down and teach all this stuff. And his job is to do cardiac angios and cardioversions and
run tests,
all the things that are procedures that make money. And so he's into making money and doing procedures. And so he can't afford to learn how to. And if he gets convinced in his head that this is correct, he will destroy his career. And he can't pay for his Mercedes anymore and his housing and you know, his kids' college and whatever, so he can't afford it.
And that's
honest to God truth. And you know, that's really one of the problems that we have in our society, is that money controls most everything. And you know, what do they say about those that have the goal make the rules?
That's right.
And that's very true in medicine. It's true in education. It's true in pretty much everything we have. Yeah, so.
That's so fascinating. So heavy metals is a part of what you're doing, but it's one piece of many different biological, you know, cascading effects of different injuries and yeast infections. So if someone were to have a neck injury, but they don't have an overgrowth of candida and yeast in the body, then they just sort of don't express any of the symptoms?
Generally, or vice versa. True. Now, I've seen a few cases where they have paralysis, they have the injury to the neck, but then they've lost muscle mass in the back. So
the
between
back.
The scapulas, and the scapulas become winged, and they've lost some degree of functionality in their legs, but it's a stable disease. And so So again, the spinal nerves are injured and whatnot, but it's not got the infection process that's mm-hmm. connecting it to
connect it to the spinal cord. So if people are having issues with this type of situation, and generally, like you said, I mean, you gave that example of a really extreme case of that guy who was, you know, 62 years later or
when he was 12, my gosh.
Yeah, so if generally the quicker you get on it, the better results you're going to get.
Yeah, like stroke, heart attacks, things like that are extremely, conducive to treatment if you get to them quickly. Now, congestive heart failure, you can treat them pretty much any time. Now, congestive heart failure, there's a variety of different kinds of congestive heart failure, so you can't generalize in total, mm-hmm. but if it's like from coronary artery disease, you can really help a person a lot. I just give you examples. One of my friends had coronary artery disease. No, he had mitral valve disease. That's what he had. He had mitral valve disease, and he developed congestive heart failure, and he was told that he needed surgery, but he was so sick that he couldn't do it, you know, because his heart was so damaged mm-hmm. from the congestive heart failure. And so he came to me and I said, okay, we'll give you stem cells and you're going to get better, but once you get better, you need to go have surgery. And he got better. And so we gave him stem cells and he got better and he went back to functioning and working, and he thought, hey, forget it. I'm out of the woods.
Yeah.
And the only trouble was he wasn't. And then 2 years later, that valve, and that problem just got to him, and he died of that.
Wow.
But he could have died. You know, he was dying when he came to me.
Right.
So I gave him 2 years, but he didn't want to listen and go do it. You know, so a lot of times people, people make up their own minds about what they want to do. And my job is to tell you all the options. Tell you what I would think I would do if I were you, but mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that you as a person are going to do any of it. You can say, oh, I'm not going to do anything. I don't want to spend any money. I don't want to do this. I just want to go crawl in a hole and, go to Hawaii and lay on the beach until
I'm 72 and I'm good.
So
we had a question the other day from a friend of ours who has severe rheumatoid arthritis. Mm-hmm. What would stem cell do for somebody in that situation?
Well, it helps, and again, rheumatoid is another one of those diseases that are, can be complicated. A lot of times there's infections, mm-hmm. chronic infections, and strep infection is one. There's like 72% of all cases of rheumatoid have strep antibodies that are consistent with initiating the disease. I've had patients with three or four different parasites, so you can have those kind of things. So infections of one type or another can trigger the whole thing. I think that you have to look at the yeast again and all these different bugs. The chronic and systemic lupus erythematosus is somewhat the same. Most all of these chronic diseases have some component of infection. And unfortunately, the doctors do a blood count and your white blood count is normal, so you don't have an infection. Because of that, and the labs that we have, like LabCorp or Quest, they don't do adequate stool tests to really analyze. In fact, I don't have a good lab test, a lab that does a really excellent stool test. There is nobody that really does a really great one because it costs too much money. Mm-hmm. The testing facilities require very special equipment, and they're very expensive. And so it has to be processed. There's, for example, on a urine organic acid test, which measures these metabolites from bacteria, mm-hmm. one urine sample has something like 3,500 to 4,000 metabolites that you can measure.
That you can measure.
Which you can measure. Now, what do you do with 4,000 metabolites? First of all, it takes a week to run, which a machine is called a mass spectrometer. Mm-hmm. So it takes one urine sample, put it into a mass spectrometer, which costs you $600,000.
So
you got $600,000 invested in the machine for a week of urine spinning, taking one urine sample and analyzing it. Now you get this 4,000 metabolites.
And
now
then,
what do you do?
Then what do you
now,
do?
Now what do you do with it? Now you have to sit there and figure out each one of these metabolites. And how do you do that? And, because they're very strange chemicals, and virtually a lot, most of them are not even listed, other than maybe you can make a name to it if you wanted to spend some time, but there's no studies on it or whatnot. So, you know, just like these patients with ALS, I'm sure there's a number of toxins in their urine that we haven't measured yet, and everybody's different. And so, but how do you know which one is toxic and which one isn't?
Mm.
That's a real dilemma.
So where are we with that? Are we?
Well, yeah, good
question. We're in no man's land right now. And so, you know, I don't have money. I haven't got a nickel from anybody for doing any research. I got some rich clients that have given me a little bit of money that has helped
allowed me to
do some stuff, but I could use a lot more. I mean, I sure don't have money to buy a mass spectrometer and to have a guy that I pay $10,000 a month to run it.
Sure.
And then
all the other stuff to go with.
So most patients that come in, do you treat them as if just everyone has these underlying infections?
I do the testing and I start them on that. And we're just setting it up so that people who are interested can go to my website, stemcellmd.org, and we have a list of the tests that we want to do. And you can order the tests. I think we charge you $15 for shipping and handling to send you the kits. And then you take the kits, send them off, and then as soon as you start, after you finish your test, then we get together and I start prescribing medications to start treating all these things. And frankly, these are not easy infestations to get rid of. They've been there for many years, and they have become part and parcel of the person. And I've been working hard trying to come up with the answer how to clean up the system so that we can cure these people. But we're still in that process of trying to decide or trying to determine what is the ultimate cure-all, if you will, for cleaning up this gut and getting rid of these bugs. So we're right in the thick of that whole process. So I've got on the website, I've got a diet. It turns out that olive oil, extra virgin olive oil, is helpful. Coconut oil is helpful. Soybean proteins are helpful. Genistein is helpful. It goes on. There's a lot of things that are helpful, but garlic is helpful. And so like 1 teaspoon of garlic 3 times a day is helpful.
In terms of regulating candida?
And it works with the antifungal. So if you have fluconazole, which is your standard drug that I use, and nystatin, Sporinox, or Nizoral, any of those, the garlic has a compound called allicin, and that helps have a synergistic killing effect on the yeast. And so that's helpful. If they come to the office, we're trying DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide, helps solubilize the cell wall. We've got a new product that's a probiotic that has an enzyme called chitinase, which dissolves the yeast wall. So it goes on and on. There's lots and lots of factors. And I think on my Facebook, I've got some guy I put out this article about the brain ALS patients with all having fungus, and somebody wrote in and said, "Well, we talked to you and we tried antifungals and we tried for all this time. It didn't do anything."
Hmm.
And I said, "Well, yeah, but you know," and they also said that I had said that there was a cervical cord problem, and the person didn't have any cervical cord problem. I said, "No, I never said they had cervical cord. I said a cervical spinal nerve." And so one office call, you know, they call me on a phone, and they got their fax screwed up. And this guy was a doctor, so he knew everything, and he's not going to call me back and check in more because he already knows so much. His ego is so strong.
Yeah.
And so, here I am in the thick of it. It's all I do is think about this stuff and how to take care of it. And here's some guy who, in an hour, he's going to pick up what I have studied full time.
Your whole life.
And it's all for the last 3 or 4 years. It's nothing but ALS, basically. And now, I mean, I know a lot about stroke. You know, people say, "Well, why are you not pushing stroke?" Well, to me, stroke is stroke because we have such great results with stroke. I'm not interested much in terms of advertising for it because people should start to figure it out, but they're not.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But
But something like ALS is sort of like an ongoing puzzle.
I tell you, what I really feel most strongly about is cerebral palsy. And the reason why is that, you know, the people with stroke, that's their own problems. I mean, they've had a stroke. They're smart enough. They got money enough. If they had smarts, they'd find me and come to me and do it. And so, obviously, they're not that smart.
Yeah. It's more cut and dry. You know?
Yeah. Whereas cerebral palsy, these kids have got no chance. They don't know anything about anything. They don't have, you know, they don't have much money. Parents don't have much money and all that. But yet, stem cells do more good for cerebral palsy than any other therapy ever and will. And you can take a child who's a full quadriplegic, who cannot talk, who cannot speak, who cannot walk, he can't function.
I've seen one of the videos on your site.
You know, and within a few days sometimes, they're able to use their legs, their arms, and start to talk, and they can see. I've seen them. I've got like at least five cases of kids who were totally blind and now can see because of stem cells. And, you know, those to me are miracles.
That's just
amazing. And yet, we don't hear anything about it. The cerebral palsy association doesn't promote it. You know, it's like, what the heck is wrong with this world when we got such a great therapy for conditions like stroke, like congestive heart failure, like cerebral palsy and Parkinson's. I mean, I've had great results with Parkinson's. But the point is that cerebral palsy is so easy to treat, and yet and nobody's treating them.
And what about the deformations in the physical limbs and things with cases like cerebral palsy?
Well,
how does that come back?
I have people come all the time like that and have problems, and they're going to have an operation for this or for that, you know, because of spasticity and deformations. And you know, I tell them, you know, I don't know. We never know until we try. Let's try stem cells first and see what happens, because if your stem cells really work and the brain changes and everything gets better, you may find that you don't need to do these operations, because these operations are because of the damage in the brain. Mm-hmm. And the operation of the brain is damaged and causes the spasticity, and the spasticity is causing the deformity. About 80% of the spasticity can go away with stem cells. That's a lot.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's not going to cure them all, but again, we're still trying different things and different routes and different amounts and all that kind of thing to see, you know, to improve our results. But in general, about 70-80% of all the patients have really good results.
What is the disease that Michael J. Fox has? What is that?
Parkinson's.
Yeah. And you work with that as well.
Well, yeah, Parkinson's very interesting in that sense that they have the gut problems too.
Okay.
And oftentimes have fungal infections too.
Very similar then.
And they have the tumor necrosis factor elevations also.
Okay.
And they also have something else, and that is that they have burned fat. Their fat, they may be eating too many fried foods, or they have they've gotten into chemicals that cause oxidation, rusting of the fats in that part of the brain, the substantia nigra and whatnot. And if you give these people polyunsaturated fats, especially omega-3, in high doses, oftentimes you'll see like 60-70% improvement, just that alone.
Do you mean high doses like
15 grams a day?
But IV or is
it? No, oral.
Just oral.
Just oral, yeah.
Okay.
You have to take a little bit of vitamin E along with it, and then you have to stay away from saturated fats. And try to clean up the gut. So you have all these, and then you have, sometimes you'll have, some of these people have had, it's vascular dementia, like a vascular dementia, but it's vascular Parkinson's, and the way you tell that is by looking at the CAT scans or the MRIs, and you can look at their blood, if they have high cholesterol, they have this Parkinsonian-like symptoms, and if they have really high cholesterol and they've had it for a while, it's probably vascular Parkinson's. And so you have to kind of go by the history, by this and by that, and you can differentiate that way, and then you can treat. So a person with vascular, you want to get them on chelation. They have also iron and copper deposits in their brain, and this triggering the lipid peroxidation. And so lipid peroxidation, rusting of these membranes are really what's causing this inability of the cell membranes to interact with each other to cause the Parkinson's.
Wow, that's fascinating. So when you're working with people, is there a standard, like, for example, if someone were to come in with Parkinson's versus ALS or something, is there a standard sort of treatment, and then you sort of cherry pick things that work for individuals? Or How do you come up with a treatment for people?
I have this saying about out with the bad and in with the good.
Yeah.
And that's basically what I think is necessary for all these conditions. So that's the simplest answer.
Okay.
But then going on to more specific, I would say that those tests that I order are general because nobody else, doctors, don't do them. And so it gives me a clue as to what's going on. That's the CDSA, the Comprehensive Digestive Stool Test, uh-huh. a urine organic acid test, and a heavy metal challenge.
Okay.
Those tell me, do you have lead? Do you have mercury? Do you have arsenic? Do you have this or that? It tells me if you have yeast infestations. Yeast, okay. It tells me if you have a gut dysbiosis. It tells me if you have a serotonin malabsorption problem. It can tell me if you have too many neurotransmitters or too little, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. And so, and then the bacteria and yeast and tells me if you have clostridia, fungus, et cetera. And it gives me things like secretory IgA and all that. All these things are markers for inflammation. So if I find that you have inflammation in the gut, that's one thing. If I see that you got yeast markers in the urine, that's another. If you have yeast in both stool and urine and you have inflammatory markers, we know that there's a chronic yeast infestation. Mm-hmm. If you have antibodies in the blood, we know for a fact, again, that you do. And so, and there's been studies.
And then high heavy metals as well.
Yeah, and then you have, so you have to work on all of those things sometimes. Now, multiple sclerosis is the same kind of thing. And sometimes with just doing those things, getting rid of the yeast and getting rid of the bugs and getting rid of the heavy metals, you can put a person with multiple sclerosis into remission without stem cells. Now, many times I still use stem cells because they do really work well in MS, but if you don't have the yeast out and if you don't have the heavy metals out and all that,
they will have
a reoccurrence. And so reoccurrences are why I do all these tests to prevent those, because if we can get rid of all the poisons and all the things that are causing it, then the stem cells can work to repair, because stem cells can't take away the heavy metals, they can't take away the yeast, they can't take away all these things.
They can't take away
take these bad things. They can't change the pathology. We've got to do something about the pathology.
Right.
And then once the pathology is cleared up, then we can repair the damaged tissue with the stem cells. So tissues are repaired by stem cells, but the stem cells cannot take out the bad things.
That makes sense.
Go ahead. We have an interesting question in the chat room.
I want to ask you a question mm-hmm. after that, but this is just too good. I want to make sure to get the chat room.
I thought
questions.
This was really interesting. Our friend Jenny in the chat room says, I'm interested in the application for self-harvested stem cells for thymus/immune stimulation and metabolic/epigenetic repair. Is it possible, or would this type of repair need to be donor stem cells? How does that work with donor versus self-harvested stem cells?
Interesting question.
Yeah.
What is that again?
Kind of intense, huh?
Yeah.
I'm interested in the application for self-harvested stem cells for the thymus or immune stimulation and metabolic/epigenetic repair. Is it possible, or would this type of repair need to be donor stem cells?
Wow, that's above my pay grade. I don't know.
Maybe above mine too. There really has been, there's a lady out of Mexico City that's been doing some of that kind of work. I haven't heard anything from that section for 4 or 5 years, so I'm not so sure where she's at with that. Thymus, the older, it depends. This person doesn't say how old she is or whatnot, mm-hmm. and what these problems are. So, your thymus is at its maximum about 12 of your age. 12 years of age, your thymus is at its maximum. And then, and then at the age of 50, it becomes fairly atrophied and starts to allow for autoimmune dysregulations to occur. And so there's been some thought that if you can rebuild the thymus, then you can help with autoimmune disease and cancer and a variety of things. Now there's another, let's see, how does it go? There was a paper many years ago in the Journal of Gerontology where there was a problem with the thymus created a situation where there's a change in the liver metabolism and change of polyploidy, where so the DNA doubled and quadrupled. There's many cells in the liver that change because of that. So there's obviously some changes that can go on in the body. And there's a variety of different thymus fractions that have been touted. There's an Australian company that is using I forget the name of it, but there's a new fraction of thymus that's being used for things like eye problems and whatnot that is going through clinical trials. But to get in to do a, you know, if she's asking if we're going to operate, take out pieces of the thymus and then grow that in tissue culture and try to revitalize that, I have never done that. So I really am not in any position to tell you that. As far as immune stimulation, you can't use, in general, you can't use stem cells for immune stimulation. You can use it for reconstitution. And so if you're going to, what you do is reconstitute, and then you can rebuild the immune system by using, for example, arginine and lysine, 1-to-1 ratio in your diet will stimulate your thymus to regenerate. So that's something that's kind of unknown, but helps. And now another thing that helps is direct immune stimulation by injections of certain bacterial cell wall products. And so, like, there's an agent that we used to use called MRV. It was a mixed respiratory vaccine, and we give a shot to the person once a week for 12 weeks, and that would rebuild the thymus. Now, there's another one called Staph lysate, which may be available, I'm not so sure. So that we've had a back in the 70s and 80s, we had quite a bit of immunological therapies going on. And since the last 10 years or so, we've kind of lost a lot of that immune therapy kind of modulation availability from a commercial point of view. So I'm not so sure what's available now for immune stimulants like that. I know BCG is still available. So some of those things, candida is a candida extract that can be used as well. So, some of those things could be used to help stimulate the thymus if that's the problem. Now, if there's some genetic problem, then what you have to do is do a HLA matching, and I take the person's blood, send it to the lab at UCLA, get her HLA tissue typing, then I go to the cord blood banks and get cord blood that is matched to her, and then we can grow HLA-matched cord stem cells and use those to repair her body in terms of her genetics and all that. Now, that's the way I do that is I give shots of that on a daily basis for about 2 weeks, and then after that, then inject those into the bone marrow so that she's got HLA-matched cord stem cells into her bone marrow, and she's had this preconditioning effect with the weekly or the daily shots for the 2 weeks before. So the combination gives her what's called a chimera, and so then that will stay in her system forever, and she has these genes that are healthy genes that are working to help fix whatever it is. So that's as close as I can get to fixing that thymus for her.
What a wild
It's a
process.
Very, very complex.
How important is it for people to get their baby's cord blood done these days?
Yeah, we're just talking about
that. Is that really important for people, in your opinion?
Well, that's a very, very debatable question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think if you have plenty of money to spend, why not? What the heck?
Well, it was only, it was $2,000 from what our friends told us. And I thought, that's expensive, but I thought, wow, if it can do what people think it can do, then that's not that much.
Yeah. It's like going and playing. It's about like playing the California lottery, frankly.
Yeah.
If you put in $2,000 in the California lottery, you're going to get maybe $50. Really. Swear to God, it's the worst bet in the world.
Yeah.
Go to Pechanga or whatever. Much better. Any place else besides the California lottery. Yeah. I just so fed up with that.
Yeah.
I've tried it enough to know that this is just not a good bet for anybody.
Yeah.
But, it's the same thing. You're putting $2,000 down, and basically you're hoping that that money is never going to be used, and it's going to sit there, and that cord is going to be there for the next 20 years.
And
so you have to bet that the company is going to be there for 20 years.
Exactly.
So that is a question. So, you can pay in the money and keep paying, but then next year they may go bankrupt, and now what do they do?
Mm-hmm.
And what are they going to do, and who knows who's going to do what? Usually they're, in that kind of thing, they sell it to another company and all that, so you're okay. But you never know.
You never know.
I mean, look at how many times big companies have gone out of business, and how in the world are they, it's just always constant changes in this world we live in.
Yeah.
So you never know.
Yeah.
But again, it's the cord babies, it's the baby stem cells, and if the baby does develop some type of cancer, this is the kind of cell that you want to be able to give to that baby after they've had chemo to revitalize, to give them back their natural bone marrow and give them a cure. So it's the only real cure that you have that is going to be natural, if you will, as compared to allogenic. That's autologous. This now, allogenic is somebody else's cord blood. And you can do like I was just describing with that and all that. But again, that whole business is still not, let's should we say, officially recognized by the FDA as as a treatment for cancer as such. Now, they are doing it, and they're using unmatched. They're using unmatched and matched. So they take HLA-matched cord blood, and they take the cord blood and give that to the baby after they've had chemo. But it's cord blood. Not cord stem cells. There's a big difference, and people don't understand that.
Yes.
And the doctors don't seem to understand it, and the FDA sure doesn't understand it because
the doctors don't understand.
No, they don't. And because you know, right now we have one company that makes umbilical cord blood that's FDA approved for this use, and it's whole blood. And in other words, it's not whole blood. It's the white blood cells. Okay. So they take the white blood cells out of the cord blood, freeze that down, and now they give that to you. And they charge $35,000 for that.
Whoa.
I think something like that. But it's FDA approved.
Okay, really?
So insurance may cover a lot of it because it's for a patient now who has got cancer. And so, but the only trouble is it's not stem cells. These are white blood cells. And so they have to be HLA matched, and you're going to have graft versus host reactions because there are cells in there that are not stem cells.
Can you cultivate stem cells later?
Yeah, you could. You could, but they don't. The FDA has not allowed that and not given any permission to do that and not have. That's why we don't have pure stem cells available because of the FDA.
Could you imagine? I just think. Could you imagine? What if there were complete freedom, medical freedom, you know, in here? And could you imagine if the landscape were littered with guys like you doing research on this type of thing? Where could we be without any constraints? I mean, I wonder what's possible, you know, with stem cells, hyperbaric oxygen.
Well, if
disease.
Everybody was honest and above board and trying their best to do good, we'd be far, far ahead.
We'd be way far
but
ahead.
But unfortunately, we don't have that world. We have a bunch of dishonest doctors, scientists, and business people and politicians all conspiring to steal our money and give us bad health in the process. Mm-hmm. And now they may not say that, but in reality, they do. And
that's just so what they do.
That's what they do.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not only in this country, it's in every country around the world. We have corruption globally, and that's, you know, what our biggest problem is throughout the world.
Are you are you excited about where stem cells is going or could go?
Well, I've been excited about stem cells since I got into it, and I continue to be every day excited. I mean, I can't hardly sleep. I mean, really, I cannot hardly sleep because I'm so excited about what I'm doing and what I'm finding and what I'm discovering and
that is so
all
cool.
that. So it's I'm fully into this whole thing, and I really have very little time for anything else, much to the chagrin of my family.
Yeah.
So you know, that's part of the problem with being so devoted, and not devoted is not really the word. I'm just so interested. I guess is really I'm so interested and so intrigued by the whole thing, and every day I'm discovering. Discovering new things there's so much to learn and so much to discover and so much to put together, so many synergistic things and so many things that need to be known. It just goes on and on. I have now in my library, you know, I don't know if we ever talked about my library, but I've been collecting medical journal articles since 1964, and I now have over 1 million articles that I have handpicked out of millions and millions of journals, books, and whatnot. But I didn't want into the trash. I was a member of the American Medical Library Association for many years, and the American Medical Library Association had a deal that if you wanted any of their extra books that they had, extra journals, you just had to send them a postcard, and they would send them all to you, and just to have to pay for postage.
Really? And so you went hog wild.
Yeah, I had literally semi truckloads of books coming to me over the years, and my wife would go, "Are you kidding?
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious."
She thinks it's her new couch being delivered.
I know. Where's that
a
couch?
A million papers. Where do you keep these?
I have. It's part of my office lab.
It's like the Library of Alexandria in Southern California.
So I got something like 50,000 books, all medical books, all scientific books, mostly pharmacy, drugs, natural things.
So you use those as reference and then you read some of them.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do is take that data and bring it to the patient. You know, it's a matter of organizing. I'm saying every day I look at this stuff and I say, you got to get organized.
Man.
With all your extra time.
Right, that's right. So
wow.
That's fascinating. Now, can people do stem cells or oxygen therapy or some of the things, the more radical things that you do? Can people do this if they're relatively healthy? They just want to become healthier? They just want to sort of maintenance? Or is it only for not necessarily, well, I guess it could be acute, but chronic issues, you know? Is it something you could do as
a... Yeah, there's a lot of people do that. For example, multiple sclerosis patients will come sometimes. They're scheduled. Sometimes they schedule themselves for once every week, every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, every month. England has like 6,000 patients being treated that way.
England?
Yeah. And so they have a very official multiple sclerosis hyperbaric kind of conglomeration of people and facilities doing this kind of therapy.
They allow that there.
Yeah, well, they allow it here too. It's not it's not disallowed. Hyperbaric oxygen is like the safest and simplest natural drug there is. Mm-hmm. Just a matter of, you know, insurance is not going to pay for it. That's all. So I think in England they may be paying for it. So
there's
a difference there. So every country is different about the rules and regulations about health care, about marriage, and getting married. How old can you get married? How many wives can you have?
Right.
So if you want to have two wives, you don't stay in California.
Yeah, you got to go to Utah.
You got to go to Utah.
Not only that, you got to get out of the United States generally. Go to Nigeria.
Yeah.
A chieftain and have four wives, no problem. Or Saudi Arabia, you still have four wives there. So the point is that every country's got its own value system and whatnot, and that just tells you that as a patient, if you have a problem and the doctor says that you have an incurable disease, you might want to start thinking about something else, somewhere else, and find out, you know, start looking in other places, because there are other places that do allow stem cells and do allow a lot of things that we don't here allow.
So with people, if they have other issues instead of neurological issues, like you mentioned cancer a while back, these are all things that could help with cancer as well. It's very important. I guess we just make sure we use the right language here. But stem cells, hyperbaric oxygen, supplementation, these are all things
can promote
that
can health.
They promote health, right? So,
well, in general, yeah, you can. Now, there's a concept that's called adaptogenics and or adaptive medicine, and that's the situation, or there's another word for it, hemostatic homeostasis, I believe it's called. In any case, hormesis, that's what the word is. Hormesis.
Oh, yeah.
Hormesis is not that. So anyway, hormesis is basically stimulating your body in a way that produces some mild degree of injury that the body reacts to, and as it reacts to, it initiates a healing response that makes you even stronger than you were before.
Okay.
And so adaptive medicine is one where you, for example, go out and exercise, and you go out and run half a mile, and you haven't been out doing anything for a long time. Well, the first day or two or three or four, you're like, to die.
Yeah.
Because you hurt so much.
I've been there.
Everything is bad and you're so exhausted. And you're like, oh my God, what is wrong with me? And then it starts to turn around and you start getting better. And the more you do it, the better you get.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the same thing with all these therapies. Oxygen, hyperbaric oxygen generates free radicals.
Uh-huh.
And so in general, most people say free radicals are bad. Well, they are bad in a lot of ways if they're continuous and in high amounts in certain areas of the different organs and all that. But when you're doing hyperbaric, you're dumping hyperbaric oxygen therapy generates free radicals. Within about an hour of treatment, there's starting to be enough free radicals to start to eat away at the tissues
okay.
that are damaged.
Okay.
It doesn't damage. It doesn't eat away at the tissues that are not damaged. So the tissues that are healthy are able to resist the free radicals, and they have these like superoxide dismutase okay. and catalase and these enzymes to protect them. But the cells that are damaged and are not very healthy, they don't have enough ATP to make enough of these enzymes, and so they're damaged by these free radicals and are killed.
Uh-huh.
And so if you want to get rid of the damaged cells that are interfering with the healing, and because they're stuck there and they can't fix themselves, they don't have enough energy to fix themselves, and you need to get them out, like old senescent cells. Those mm-hmm. are good ones to get rid of. So if you're as you get older and older, your stem cells especially, are becoming senescent, and that means that they're no longer able to replicate, and they're not able to make growth factors, and they're just sitting in your system, and they're taking up space, and they're cluttering up your body, and you can't get rid of them, and you cannot function well because they're in there causing problems, because not only do they not produce these things, but they also produce toxins.
Mm.
And so okay. if you can get rid of those by dumping free radicals in there, then, do that once you can do it. Like one of the things I was telling somebody the other day was asking me what to do about detoxification. She said, well, I'm 40, what was she? She's 48, and I just haven't done anything. I've been eating all these things that I shouldn't be.
Yeah.
I just want to, detoxify. Should I go have a colonic?
Yeah.
Right.
I should say one colonic is going to clean me up. I don't think so.
Yeah.
But what can help would be something like an Epsom salt. It was developed by a man by the name of Guleppi in 1903 in Paris. And he wrote a book about it, and he used like one heaping tablespoon of Epsom salts and 8 ounces of water, and you take that in the evening twice. So you take two glasses if you can choke them down.
If you can do that.
And then what you do is basically you have bowel movements you start having bowel movements about 4 a.m, and you keep having them till about 9, 10 o'clock. And during that time, you're cleaning everything out, and then you go into ketosis, basically,
okay.
and you stay in ketosis as long as you don't start eating a lot of carbohydrates,
mm-hmm.
and so you have to stay on fat or protein. Now, in this situation, if you want to get rid of the oxidized proteins that are in your body, because that's part of the aging process too, which
right.
is part of what we're talking about, detoxification is trying to get rid of all the poisons. Well, these oxidized proteins are interfering with metabolism, and these are like senescent cells and whatnot. So how do you get rid of those? Well, these are if you have protein in your diet, then the protein is going to protect those cells. Your body's not going to digest those. You don't. So if you're going to clean yourself out, you want to get yourself for really cleaned of these toxic materials, you want to get rid of the protein out of your diet. So you don't want to go into a ketotic diet where you're trying to lose weight, because you're trying to protect your muscles at that point. You just want to be in ketosis, since you have fat and protein. And that's what the ketogenic diet is.
But mm-hmm. it's really popular.
In this situation,
yeah, very popular.
In this situation, you want to switch basically just vegetables for like 3 days. Nothing else but vegetables, and just eat vegetables. And with that, and especially if you eat cruciferous vegetables. So the cruciferous vegetables, like the broccoli sprouts. Broccoli sprouts are the highest in what's called sulforaphane, and that helps repair the DNA. This lady was talking about DNA repair and all that.
Yes.
So that sulforaphane generates what's called histone deacetylase. It's a histone deacetylase inhibitor, which helps the DNA function better.
Okay.
So by having a diet of vegetables, and it can be cooked, that's okay.
Cooked or raw?
Or raw.
You know,
or maybe juiced.
Yeah. Any of that is fine, as long as it doesn't tear up your gut.
Uh-huh.
And hopefully you don't have any bugs in there that are really, if you have a lot of infestations in there, then that's another story. So
yeah.
you start having that, you might have troubles. But in general, that should help clean up everything. You're going to feel a whole bunch better. And I would only do that for like 3 days and then stop that. And then maybe do that every 2 weeks or so.
Okay.
And until you're, really the way you want to be. Now, metabolically, there's probably other things going on, obviously. But if you had nothing else wrong and you're just 50, 60, 70 years old and wanted to kind of really clean yourself up and set yourself back in the right path, that's mm-hmm. a good way to go.
There's a doctor we had on the show, a great guy out of Texas, and he was just talking about the incredible benefits of the hyperbaric oxygen. He was saying that he used the phrase, it could sort of cover a multitude of sins, because it was so powerful and what it could do. And people are starting to get those tanks at home. Have you seen those little portable ones? I'm sure you know about those. And are those effective, do you think?
Oh, they're somewhat effective. As I was saying, with hyperbaric oxygen, it generates free radicals. And that then, of course, that causes, again, the same kind of things. Like the same person that I'm talking about with the Epsom salts and the vegetables, if they did hyperbaric oxygen on a daily basis during that time, then that's going to be one more factor that kills and destroys those toxic cells, the toxic proteins, the oxidized things, because those free radicals are going to burn out. Now, you don't want to do an hour only. You want to do at least an hour and a half or 2 hours of treatment every day for those 3 or 4 days, because the burning, the damage to these oxidized proteins and cells that are not healthy starts to occur at 1 hour. And so if you stop at 1 hour, you really haven't done, you just gotten to the body to the point where it's starting to really eat away all the toxins now. So you want to just keep on going. Now, the reason I know all about that is because stroke patients have all this damage in their head, and this damage is sitting there doing nothing. It's getting in the way. And so I always tell people, well, look, it's like we're sitting in this nice room. We have lights on, everything's working, we're all talking to each other, and everything's fine. But now, what if some terrorist drops a bomb on us and tells us, you have 5 minutes to get out, and we get out, and the thing blows up, and we come back, and everything is pretty well destroyed. And we're going to say, well, should we pick up where we started, where we were? No, we really have a hard time trying to go back to what we were just doing, because we don't have a table anymore, we don't have, chairs to sit on. There's dust and crud everywhere. It's just impossible. So what do you have to do? You have to call in the cleaning crew and clean up everything. And that's what hyperbaric oxygen is. It's a cleaning crew. It comes in and cleans up that debris that is there. There's no other way that really can get in there. And I mean, the body has some cleaning crew. It's sort of like one little old lady comes in with a little dustpan and says, yeah, I can take care of some of this. Yeah. but what you need is a whole crew. You need, 10, 12 people with every kind of device, and go in there and really clean it up. And the sooner you get it all cleaned up, the more quickly you're able to get things back to running again.
So fascinating, this whole stem cell thing. For me, I just think it's so fascinating. I'm sure there's lots of different applications. I know there's a guy up in LA somewhere who's doing something, I'm sure you know about this, Regenikine for sports injuries. And there's people that, go to Germany, athletes will go to Germany. Are stem cells able to be used for like torn ligaments?
Very good results with bone, arthritic joints and tendons and all that.
And torn.
Have you asked him on the last show that I wasn't able to be on what the difference is between, in your case, with a torn ACL, with prolotherapy versus a stem cell? Do they do completely different things?
Well, the prolotherapy is one of stimulating inflammation and increasing fibroblast proliferation to increase connective tissue growth in that area to strengthen things. That can be quite helpful, but it also can not work too. Uh-huh. But then stem cells are the same way too.
Interesting.
I've had a lot of prolotherapy on my shoulders and everything. I didn't see anything. Uh-huh. With stem cells, I generally see good results with shoulder injuries, for example. So I'm kind of, of course, I'm prejudiced because I use a lot of stem cells.
Stem
cells all the time. And I never was really interested in sticking poisons, basically, because that's what you're doing. You're sticking irritative substances into a person's body to help irritate the body's tissue so that they generate these reactive collagen molecules to help strengthen things. And So there's, there's good points on both sides.
Yeah.
And if it works for you, it's cheaper probably if you can get by with a couple, three treatments. But
with the prolo,
the prolotherapy. Uh-huh. Prolotherapy is cheaper. PRP is cheaper as well. Mm-hmm. So PRP is also something that you didn't mention, but that's the same in that same category.
Yeah.
So all three are beneficial. So you can start with one and see if it works, and go to the next and see if that works, and finally wind up over with me.
Stem cells. We had PRP with our teeth. We got our wisdom tooth extracted and root canals taken out, and he used PRP, the biological dentist we use.
That was cool.
Yeah, fascinating. You want to take a couple quick chat room questions?
A couple folks just really wanted to know the doctor's thoughts on these stem cell activating drops. Have you heard of these things? A lot of companies. Stephen Hewer, who we had on, has these things called Medics for Life, advanced stem cell technologies, rapidly repair and heal faster using these drops. Have you heard of anything about
never heard of those drops. I mean, I know about
yeah.
Yeah, I have a product myself called Stemgevity, which is basically, you know, it has, there's a number of kinds of stem cells. And so the most common one that we people think about is CD34, which is a hematopoietic. And then there's the mesenchymal stem cells. Now, mesenchymal stem cells cannot be mobilized in general, so you may as well forget about stimulating them. But
okay.
So the hematopoietics are the ones that are being able to be mobilized out of the bone marrow from trauma or from these drops or from Stemgevity or whatnot. And so there's a number of different agents that can help that. And the question, of course, is which ones are most effective. You know, it comes down to you find if you have some product that looks good and you've talked to people that have got some results out of it, then sure. Now, if you have some serious problem, there's nothing wrong with, I think, taking 3 or 4 of these products. You know, we're talking about each one maybe sells for anywhere from, say, $40 to $50, $60 a month. All right. Now, if you have a stroke and are needing to be rehabilitated, and you were to compare using, say, 3 of these products at a cost of $200 a month as compared to having stem cells, the cost is much, much less by taking 2 or 3 products. So trying to decide on one product alone is, I think, fraught with difficulty because everybody that's selling these things is making claims that they have got the best and they got the data and all that. You just really have a hard time I have to find this product and then I've got to test it compared to mine, and that costs money. And what do I do with it? I mean, after I find out that it's better or less better, what do I do? Do I tell you on radio that, oh, I tested that and it sucks?
Or not, or better.
Right,
because if
right.
it's better, then I'm not going to sell any. If right. it's worse and I say that, then I get sued.
Yeah.
So I'm in no man's land as far as helping the public know what's to do. You know,
right.
I mean, really, you can't tell a person what is right because of all these problems.
I see.
So
that.
It's really you're between the devil and a
rock and a hard place.
Rock and a hard place. Yeah.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, there was a. Let's see. Jenny wrote a couple quick questions here. In relation to the possibility of bone marrow blood harvested stem cells to rebuild liver metabolic pathways and immune system damage from pharmaceuticals?
In relation to the possibility
of... Did she ask a previous question here? let's see. It looks like it's kind of a tag along to maybe something else that she said.
Well, I do think at the end here, she has a great question too that says, if a client were to come and stay near the clinic, do a lot of people travel to come to your clinic?
People from all over the world.
For serious health challenges, how long in general, I mean, everyone's going to be different, but how long are people's stays?
You know, it varies depending upon the patient and the condition. So, for example, cerebral palsy, I would say most of them come for one day because cerebral palsy children don't have heavy metal issues. They don't have gut problems. They only got his brain problems. And it's a white matter brain problem, and stem cells go right to that area and help fix it. So they don't need to have anything. Now, if you have Parkinson's and you come out of the woodwork and you've been seeing a typical neurologist who doesn't do anything, and you come in and I say, well, okay. And I look at you and you've got fungus growing out of your toenails and fingernails and out of your tympanic membranes in your ears, and I can see it on your tongue. I have to treat for yeast. It depends then, and then maybe you've got heavy metals, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, do we want to clean up all these things? Do we want to fix all these things first before you do stem cells? Some people say yes, and they will spend the time and money to do that. And other people will say, no, just give me the stem cells. And so I say, well, I think it's best to get rid of all these things. And they'll say, well, I don't have time for it. I know what I'm doing. I got money to spend on myself. That's okay. I just want stem cells. Okay, that's fine. I had, for example, one of my secretaries came and said, "Yeah, I've got chronic fatigue syndrome. I want to have stem cells." I said, "Well, why don't you give me all your records? Let me review everything, and let me come up with, you know, see what I can see, what you've done, and what labs you've had, and all this kind of thing." And,
sure.
And she said, "Oh, no, no. I've seen 20 some doctors. They've gone through every test in the world. I know what I've got. I know that stem cells are going to work. I don't want to have any more tests. I don't want you to have any. You don't need to review anything. I refuse to do that. I just want you to give me stem cells." I said, "Well, it's expensive, and I know you could be wasting your time and your money, and more your money than your time." And I said, "I don't care. I know I'm right. I know stem cells are going to fix me." I said, "Well, I just want to make sure that you understand it." And all right. And
give me stem cells or give me death. Give me death.
Right, yeah.
She was, by hell or high water.
She was, yeah. You know, she's one of these. She's that just, she knows what she's doing, by God. And you can't tell her different.
That's funny.
And so I gave her stem cells. And about 2 months later, I said, "How are you doing?" She said, "Oh, not any better." And I said, "Well, okay. Well, what happened?" "Well, about 2 weeks later after the stem cells, I got another case of herpes." I've always been having herpes, and I just got another case. Maybe that interfered. I said, "You didn't tell me you had herpes." Yeah. You know, it would have made a big difference if I had known you had herpes, because I would have put you on antiviral drugs, because I know, you know, when you take stem cells, the herpes viruses are going to tend to come out on you, because in fact, people don't want to hear this, but stem cells do have some immune suppressing effect. That's why we do use it on rheumatoid arthritis, and we do use it on MS, and we do use it on all these inflammatory conditions, because it suppresses the inflammation and suppresses the immune system. Here you are with a chronic herpes virus, and the herpes virus, of course, flared up, and that killed all the stem cells, and so you don't get any results. So
interesting. Wow. Yeah.
So she was wrong, unfortunately.
Have you had a lot of cases where you've sort of had to do a lot of research in terms of the real difficult case, and then you found one little thing that you tweaked, and you got great results?
Yes, but I'm sure don't ask me which one those were. Yeah, that one little magic bullet was.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, you.
I love that. What was that magic bullet? So we can do it on everybody. that one little magic bullet.
Yeah.
If I had that one little magic bullet, I would not be sitting here. I'd be calling
you'd be
you
sitting
from
in Tahiti.
That's right, on my yacht, saying, "Yeah, I found the magic bullet. Yeah. Ha ha."
Yeah.
There's a lot of magic bullets. It's just a matter of knowledge, you know. One of the things that I see, you know, over, you know, whatever it is, I started practicing in 78, so you figure out how many years that is.
36. That's 36. What year I was born.
Nice. I think it's a little bit more than
which
that.
Which is bizarre, isn't it?
It's like 46 years. And so...
I'm 50. Do I look 55, guys?
No, you're looking good. You're looking good.
So, but anyway, the point is that many times every day, if you're doing a very heavy practice, you know, seeing a lot of patients, every day you have one or two patients that have been told that there's nothing else can be done, mm-hmm. and they are incurable, and yet you know that somewhere somebody's got the answer.
Yeah.
Right.
And you just don't know who to call and how to find that out. And so part of what I was trying to do with all these collections of papers and books was to put together a kind of a information center for people like that, mm-hmm. so that, you know, we could charge money to help them find the answers. And my research with ALS has found that it is not an easy thing to find the answer for one kind of case.
Right.
And so it's taken me 3 years of full-time basically work to come to this conclusion where I'm at today, and to the point where I think I pretty well know what's going on and how to fix it, but try naming something else, and now we're back in the same situation.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so trying to solve everybody's problem is hard, but it would be nice if the government did that. I tried to talk to the NIH here about, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago about this, and they told me to take a hike because they weren't interested in that kind of a thing for some reason, you know. And that was reminds me of, we were talking about Alzheimer's before, and I was starting on a story about the National Institute of Aging, and the guy that was the head of it was an Armenian at the time, and he and I met at a conference, and we got into this argument about biomarkers and identifying tests that would identify Alzheimer's, and he was of the opinion that the NIA, the National Institute of Aging, had to spend money on development of a test for Alzheimer's. Because that was, once we have a test, then we can use that to determine whatever treatments we're using is working or not. And I said to him, "Well, since there's so much variety in all these cases and there's such great difficulty in diagnosing them all, why don't we just take like 100 patients, identify every little problem that they have, and treat them and try to correct all these problems and compare those patients with those that don't have everything identified and treated, and do that for 5 years and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me to buzz off, basically, that I didn't know what I was talking about, and he was going to do it that way. And today, to date, it's now 2015, July 10th, 2015, the NIA still does not have a good biomarker for Alzheimer's, and they spend hundreds of millions of dollars on this. And if they would have spent $10 million on this study, then they would have found out what the UCLA just has published here about a month ago, which shows that if you do this, you have about a 90% response rate in Alzheimer patients by just having them exercise right and do the right diets and take away the poisons out of the system. You get a tremendous response rate. So, you know, there's politics get involved, and people's ideas get involved, and doctors are great scientists and technologists, and they think that science has to solve all things, and it turns out sometimes just old nature, Mother Nature, and helping Mother Nature along fix the person is much better.
Yeah, I can see, man. Once you start getting the politics involved, man, that's a lot of regulations. You must be having a lot of fun, though. You know? Enjoying
well,
it.
Well, yeah, totally.
Yeah,
totally.
It seems so. So so the best website for people to get a hold of you is stemcellmd.org. Is that
correct?
The best place?
Yeah.
And you have a Facebook attached to that so people can...
You know, that's a good question.
Do you?
You know, I have a Facebook, but I look at it once every 2 months or so.
Yeah, you're too busy trying to save the world. You
people,
can't be
people
on
are
Facebook.
Saying, well, why aren't you... What do you think I am?
Got too much important things to do.
I mean, I don't understand it, frankly. I get all these things from everybody in the world. I don't know what this is about. What is this Facebook about? Why do I have all these people on my Facebook? Why are they on there?
I know,
you
know, right?
I mean, what is that? You know, how do I get rid of them? I don't know anything about it, you know?
I love it. Well, if it makes you feel any better, we got rid of our personal accounts a while back. We have one for the show, but it's too much.
My phone number is 949-367-8870. So people, if they are interested now,
367.
People that are interested, sometimes they're upset with me because I charge money. Can you believe it?
Imagine that.
You got to somehow live.
And they want me to give away free consultations. I say, well, you know, if you call in and make a consultation, I think, or it takes an hour. We have to collect all your records. And, you know, these cases are complicated. So we have to review all the records and look at them. And it takes time and effort for our staff and for myself. And so we charge $300 just for like an hour consultation. Mm-hmm. Now, and sometimes I can consult with a person in a half an hour, and then they say, well, I'm paying for an hour. And so I would keep on talking. I say, well, we already covered everything. You know, we spent a lot of time. I spent a lot of time reviewing your case beforehand. And all that. So, you know, but people are so, they want to. Anyway, the point is that that $300 fee is then applied towards stem cells if you do decide
if
to
you
have
go through it.
So you get that credited toward your stem cells.
Oh, good to know.
So at least you're kind of getting stuck in our system.
Yeah.
Because you want to get your stem cell credit.
that's cool.
That's a cool way to do it. Very cool.
So can people do this little consultation with you if they're living in all, you know, different states?
Oh, from all over the world. I get Skypes from Australia and Africa and India and China and whatever.
And then they would fly to your location?
Yeah, they come and stay. Now, if it's ALS, something, they come for sometimes a month, 2 months, because trying to get rid of this these infections are tremendously, terribly hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I know more about how to do it than pretty much anybody else, because that's what I do.
I like the fact that you're giving hope to people, because, I mean, I know people with ALS, and, you know, the most that can be done is sort of an easement into their condition and making them feel more comfortable. And even, you know, if they were to see you and nothing did happen, it's much more than what's being offered to them now.
Yeah, I have also on YouTube, if you put in my name, Steenblok and ALS, there's about a 9-minute spiel about the same
that you did on
what we just went through.
Okay.
You know, sort of thing. So, you know, it's been that I put out 2 or 3 years ago, so I haven't changed my mind. I'm right in the process of putting together a couple of scientific papers to get published and let the world know about this, because I think it's a major breakthrough, because nobody's ever figured this combination out and what causes. If you look at spontaneous, there's no research done on spontaneous because nobody knows, there's no model.
What do you mean spontaneous?
Spontaneous is, there's familial ALS.
Oh, okay.
Genetic, and then there's one that just happens. And the one that just happens, there's no clue as to what it is. Nobody knows, except for what I just told you.
Uh-huh.
This, what I described, correlates, and it corroborates, and it works, and it's like it's there. It's, this is like truth.
Yeah.
You know, you get to the point where you see, you put all these facts together, and you say, well, this is the way it is. That's the way it is. That's
it,
the way
it just
is.
Looks spontaneous, you know, right?
It is spontaneous in the sense that it happens because you injure yourself, and you happen to have this, and you happen to have that. Then you get this. But when you are having it, you just find that your right arm goes numb or weak. And you say, well, what's that about? Or starts to fasciculate, starts getting a little muscle cramp, little fasciculations, little fibrillations in your muscles. Well, if that's the way it starts, then it's spontaneous.
Right.
Because you didn't remember that you hurt your neck. You don't know anything about your gut. Most of the people with ALS have no stomach problems, intestinal problems at all. Mm. Their stomach is fine. There are no abdominal cramps. They don't have constipation. They don't have diarrhea. Nothing. And so... And some of them, or many of them, don't have any back pain, no neck pain, but a lot of them do. And so if you have chronic pain in the back and the neck especially, there's a pretty good chance that you have what I'm talking about. If you look at your cervical spine CAT scans and you see a neural foraminal stenosis and you have ALS, then again, that corroborates. And I can almost, I'll bet you $100, I'll bet you a free consultation that I'm correct and you know, that you do have that. If you have ALS, I'll give you, if you don't have it, I'll give you my consultation for free.
Yeah.
Because that's how positive I am. You know, you're talking about, right now it's 96% of all of our patients have this. So my statistics are amazing.
Yeah, you got the stats on your side.
And don't forget, the ALS patients at autopsy, 100% had fungal infections. So 96% have cervical spine and 100% have fungal infections.
Yeah.
And I've got evidence in the blood, the urine, and stool of fungal infections most cases. So it's pretty, I think, pretty convincing evidence.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, stacked on top of one another. Wow. Okay, so stemcellmd.org. And you have a whole host of other websites too, strokedoctor.com, stemcelltherapies.org. As well as, do you still have bonemarrowstemcelltherapies.com?
Yeah, but I don't think I'm using that for anything.
Okay. Best one is stemcellmd.org. Awesome. All right.
Fascinating.
So your phone number again is 949-367-8870?
Correct.
Wow, thank you for coming in today.
My pleasure.
Golly, I'm so glad you're in San Clemente now. You're not too far, and... Because before,
I
were so lucky, Mr. Viejo.
I know. I was just thinking last night, I said, where else would I want to live in this world? I said, let me just see, what's the best places in the world to live? And I come down and say, you know, I think San Clemente.
San Clemente's not too bad.
Is it treating you good so far?
Yeah, I love San Clemente. Mm. I really do. I think it's great.
Were you living in somewhere
else?
No,
I've been living
before?
Here from I moved here in 83.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's cool. Now your practice is here off La Pata, right? Not too far from here.
Right. Right up from 24 Hour Fitness.
Okay. Oh, right across the street?
Just up the hill.
Okay.
On Cala del Cerro.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Great location.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time, and golly, thank you for your work. We're supposed to only go for, we're 2 hours now almost. Thank you so much.
I'm sure you'll do something with it.
Yes.
Of course.
Make a long-term record or something.
I know, right? All right, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us in the chat room.
Yeah,
we really
thanks,
appreciate
guys.
It.
That
yeah.
was really cool.
ExtremeHealthRadio.com/live every Friday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific time.
And I have to say, Jenny gave the doctor a great compliment. She said, I love his passion and commitment. A doctor with an engaged heart.
I love that.
We agree.
Nice.
So.
Thanks. All right, everyone. Thank you so much. This was episode 386. So this should be live and available to the public probably Sunday on our YouTube channel and then Monday on our website. So you can check that out and get the... podcast
get
version
the replay
there.
And share it with your family and friends.
Yeah, please share, and we'll catch you guys on the next episode. Thanks for listening. Wow, well, that was just the world's longest show, wasn't it?
I think we might have to say sweet sassy molassy.
Sweet sassy molassy.
Holy guacamole. That was long. That was a great show, though.
How long was that? That was about 2 hours.
An hour and 50-something.
Yeah, my goodness.
Yeah.
We just walked Dr. Steenblok out to his car, and he informed us that he's going to go see his... grandson in a play.
His little person.
What was the play called?
Oh, I don't know, but he played a wolf.
Minion or something?
Oh, I don't know if it was... a Minion play, but then they were going to go see the movie, that new movie out, Minion.
Oh, you're so excited.
He was great.
You were just saying how funny it is. It's so great when people are so down to earth who are such geniuses.
Yeah. Talking to him, your mind's just blown and you're completely like, I don't know, like my head was spinning, and then to hear him say something like that was just so cool. You know, it's like, I'm going to go to a movie with my kiddo, you know, just
it was
really cool.
Fascinating, because I could tell within the first moments we started this show, I could tell you just revved him up and it was like, he just went for it. He just locked into this mode where he's just saying so much information. I thought, wow, this guy's just genius.
Well, did you catch that last time? Uh-oh. Is that his car key over there?
No, that's the picture we used to take the selfie.
Oh my gosh,
stick.
Okay. I'm like, he's not going very far.
He's not going to go very far.
Well, how did he just pull away from our house?
He's just dumping stem cells into his gas tank. Somehow stem cells.
Well, he's so smart, he can just think and make his car run. Off of thoughts.
Off of thought alone.
I don't even know where to start with that interview.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think that if you know anyone with, let me look at his...
Particularly his, ALS...
Yeah, he says here, stroke, cerebral palsy, traumatic brain injury. I'm thinking traumatic brain injury for people like with minor concussions. You know, you can get those from even bouncing a head off your soccer ball on your head. Parkinson's disease, autism, migraine headaches, Alzheimer's disease. Mm. I didn't even properly introduce him at the beginning. I didn't finish because I asked him where his clinic was, but he's an osteopathic physician, biochemistry, nutrition, and safe, effective therapies for patients from chronic degenerative diseases. My goodness.
What an honor to have him sitting right here with us.
He's the world's leader in stem cells. I mean, this guy is one of the leading guys in the whole world in terms of stem cells.
How is it that he lives right in our town?
I mean, I know, isn't that cool?
Pretty wild.
Yeah, so what we're going to do is he said we should come over and see his facility. So we should go there and do a YouTube video.
Let's do it. Introduce people to Dr. Steenblok, in person.
That would be cool.
Let's do that. Let's set that up.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be in the, we should try to do that within the next month, just to kind of give people an idea of who he is and what we're, I mean, they get an idea of listening to this, who he is, but seeing him and kind of seeing his facility and if they're interested in, you know, going to camp out at the facility.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing.
Yeah. So if you know anyone with
those.
You
could come grab a green juice with us.
Yeah. Hang out. Go to 24 Hour Fitness.
Right?
Play some basketball.
Why not?
Stroke patients. So yeah, if you know anyone with these issues, cerebral palsy, Parkinson's, ALS, Alzheimer's, I think it might be a good option to see what he's got going on and see if what he's doing might be able to help you.
Yay.
I mean, we know a couple people in our own lives that are going through these things right now. And might be something to look at, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
I thought it was interesting how he said at the beginning, which he said a lot of people have to think back for 15, 20 minutes or a day and think about what kind of injuries they had had. And I thought same thing when we went to Dr. Bergman's with Dr. Bergman, our chiropractor. He asked what kind of injuries we had had to our spines or our heads and we're both thinking nothing. Well, you know, the next 20 minutes, it's true. The stuff came like kind of coming back to me how the big one, I knocked myself completely to the ground in Australia when we were walking up on this cliff, you know, looking at the beach, and there was this tree just sticking out right across the sidewalk. And I had my head down looking at my dumb phone.
I remember that. Were you looking at your phone?
Yeah. Knocked me in my forehead, or my camera, it should have been, because I didn't have a cell phone at that time working.
Yeah.
But knocked me so far back, forehead down, I just landed on my back. And I thought, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, it totally rattled you. And of course, I thought I had a concussion. I saw stars, that whole thing. But you forget about those small injuries, you know, just to kind of look back and think, what could have contributed to this problem? You know,
yeah,
I don't know.
Whiplash, people have
whiplash
that from
cars.
Whiplash
all the time. Very minor whiplash.
Yeah, I mean,
like
I thought
you said,
it was
soccer ball, you know.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating. I was reading just recently where people are getting minor concussions from heading the ball, playing soccer, and you'd never think. But you know, our brain was just our skull was meant as a protective mechanism for our brain, but it wasn't meant for these sort of things to happen
string
all the time.
Sport type thing, yeah.
You know,
well, I have a client who has a kid. I had a client, I should say,
because
I don't do that anymore. Who his kid would come to me for haircuts and stuff, but he was all of 14, a huge soccer player, really amazing. I think he's going places, like really that kind of soccer player, you know.
Uh-huh.
But done so many of those headbutts, and at 14 years old, he had a mini stroke.
Really?
He was in a pool with a bunch of friends at the end of the year, I think 2 years ago, school year, having a party. Now he's 16. And yeah, he's 14 at the time and went into some sort of a, lost all his speech. People thought he was, they couldn't figure out what was going on with him. Took him in for all this testing by ambulance. And sure enough, he had had a stroke.
Wow.
And I mean, 14-year-old kid, and you think, I don't know, putting that story together with the head butting, I mean, who knows, but does seem to be, you have to be more careful with yourself than you. We're sturdy and strong, but you can't abuse the body either, you know?
Well, I was watching, I think I told you this recently, but I was watching, there's a video that our Extreme Health Radio page can follow other pages in the same way people can follow Extreme Health Radio on Facebook. And so I forget who posted this, but there was a video, I was telling you about this the other day, where this girl, 27 years old or something like that, was on some sort of birth control pill in Australia.
Okay, I didn't see this.
And there's a video of her sitting in her cubicle at work, and it's one of those, you know, cameras, you know, how they sort of film everything you know, we do these days,
mm-hmm.
where there's a video camera filming, you know, everyone, and she goes into this full stroke.
I do remember.
27 years old. And it turns out that the birth control pills that she was taking were directly correlated with that. And it was known. But these things, like there's a thing that David Wolf posted on Facebook. It was, you know, every drug that the pharmaceutical company has ever approved or has ever been proven to be damaging to our health was once approved by the FDA, you know. And so... these things are all approved, so...
It had to become that popular to affect that many people in a negative way. I mean, it just had to run rampant at some point, become the new, you know, the new popular drug.
Yeah.
I don't know, the new trend.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a great way to put that. That's disgusting.
I want to see if I can get stem cells for my knee. Because
right.
I had prolotherapy. It worked pretty good, but I'm wondering if I can take things to another level for my knee.
I think that would be crazy awesome to try.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. I like how he's just a really honest guy. He's a big advocate of, hey, let's, you know, try whatever you want. Why not try a few things? And there's good some pros and cons for both. And mm-hmm. something might work for you that doesn't work for somebody else. But I did love how confident he is in the stem cell, you know, overall.
Yeah.
Like, you know, basically I'll give you a free consultation if I'm wrong.
But yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
he's so non-ego, but uh-huh. very confident. And I love that in a good
yeah
researcher and doctor.
Yeah, I think it's really cool he's like that. And I think that, you know, and I just want to make it clear too on our show here that, you know, we're not making any claims and neither is he. These are just options, they're ideas and they're things that may or may not work for you, but they're choices. And,
right.
And that's what we want to sort of, you know, let everyone know about is, you know, the traditional medical model only has a handful of choices for you, but there are other choices and other options. And, no matter what you're dealing with, you know.
Well, and like he was saying, you know, a lot of people say, how many people have gotten a diagnosis, unfortunately, that's like you're incurable or this is the best you're ever mm-hmm. going to get. And to accept that is where all hope goes out the window.
Yeah. So as soon as you lose hope.
We're about bringing people other options.
Yep, exactly.
So we're doing this.
Yeah, so thanks everyone for joining us on the show. I know it was so long, but I appreciate you guys being a part of everything we're doing. And if we could ever help you in any way, let us know. There are lots of different ways you can help us on a financial level or non-financial level. If you go to extremehealthradio.com/join, you can learn about all the different ways you can help us. And if you don't have any money, that's okay too. You don't have to donate to our show. But if you don't have any money and you want to help support us, you can share our show on Facebook, pass our links to your friends, things like that. And on that show page, extremehealthradio.com/join, you can find out all the different ways you can help us on a financial basis and a non-financial basis. And I wanted to also say that our shows now are not only just free, they don't cost anything. There's no charge to join the website or anything like that. All of this is free, but we're also doing commercial-free shows. And so, like this conversation today with Dr. Steenblok, I'm not going to stop him in the middle of a conversation. We're having a great conversation. But in order to do free shows as well as commercial free shows, we really do need your help. And a lot of people are now supporting us on this platform called Patreon. And if you go to extremehealthradio.com/support, you can sign up to Patreon and you can donate to us on a per podcast basis. And what's really cool about it is that if you have a Facebook account, you can join Patreon in a matter of 30 seconds. It just connects right up with your Facebook account. And you don't get charged right away at the time that you make the donation to us. You only get charged at the beginning of the month. So if it's the middle of the month and you want to donate, you know, a dollar a show, then you won't get charged $4. We do four shows a week, or four shows a month. You won't get charged until the beginning of the next month.
Right.
And so another thing too is a lot of people think, oh, I'm just one person.
How does it make a difference?
How does a dollar make a difference? Or some people are donating, you know, 50 cents a show. And to be honest, those are the ones we're most excited about, because you guys will stick with us longer because it's not costing you very much per month. But it's also, it lets us know that you understand that every little bit makes a difference, and it's true.
Yeah. And we've said it before and we'll say it again, but like 20 cents, 25 cents an episode just makes us so giddy. Mm-hmm. We're so excited.
Yeah.
So don't ever think that a little amount is not worth it or not going to help. I mean, it all really helps.
It all really helps. And this is sort of the future of where free content is going online and in our type of media in the future. And we use your donations to pay not just for the cost of running the business and paying for all the equipment and service fees, but we also use it to buy our you know, go to the health food store and pay our rent and pay for different bills we have, food for Maggie and things like that. So we use, we're becoming more sustainable, and, you know, thanks to you guys. So if you do have any extra, income, even if it's just a dollar a month, it really does help. So please consider doing that. If not, share our shows on Facebook, things like that, and Twitter and all that kind of
stuff.
Tweet at us.
The little blue bird.
The little blue bird. So yeah, thank you for joining us. And
it was a lot of fun. I hope you guys learned something. Pass it on. I do really, really think that it is great if you know people dealing with these specific ailments that they might really want to look into this. So
yeah, I think so too.
I mean, ALS and Alzheimer's and things like that seems to be pretty rampant. So
yeah, like Dr. Steinbach was saying on the show that, you know, not a lot of people are talking about the kind of work that he's doing, but you know, through the use of social media and the power of people listening, the amount of people listening, if all of you guys were to share this show to your Facebook people, you know, we can get the word out about what he's doing, offering hope. And you can tell by what he's doing, he's very passionate about it, because
he hardly sleeps.
How crazy is that?
That makes me so happy.
That is so funny.
Makes me so happy.
I love it though.
Love it.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to find that kind of passion from other doctors, no. From, you know, just traditional medical doctors. He's cool.
He's great. He's our new buddy, Dr. Steinbach.
New buddy. All right, so yeah, please join us. And on this show page, we will have all the links that Kate was so kind enough to take notes for all of you. So we'll link everything up that we talked about during today's show, extremehealthradio.com/386. And we need to go have some food, right?
Gonna go slice open me an avocado. Slice me open an avocado.
Nice.
Slice open me. That doesn't sound.
That's not good. That doesn't sound too good.
Slice me open.
How's your stomach? Good?
So far, so good today.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. Next free for all, kind of maybe talk a little bit about what's going on. But yeah, so far, so good. Awesome. Had a nice green juice here with Dr. Steinbach, and that was really helpful.
That was
great.
Good.
Way to start a Friday.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend, and we'll catch you guys on the next episode.
Hey, everybody, this is Josie, Justin's mom. Don't tell him, but I know he would absolutely be really happy if you would sign up to his free weekly newsletter. And don't forget to share this with all your friends. This is the buzzing bumblebee signing off.
That was so good.
That's where we get the bumble.
Oh my gosh.
Thank you for listening to this episode.
It's time to go for now, but our mission does not end with this show.
Justin and Kate will be back with another interview packed full of ideas, discoveries, and unique ways to regain your health.
Head on over to extremehealthradio.com/subscribe and instantly download our free gift too that contains cutting-edge strategies to start making healthy lifestyle changes today.
No material on this blog is intended to suggest that you should not seek professional medical care. Always work with qualified medical professionals, even if you educate yourself in the field of live food, nutrition, and alternative medicine. I'm not a doctor, nor am I offering readers medical advice of any kind. None of the information offered here should be interpreted as a diagnosis of any disease, nor an attempt to treat or prevent any disease or condition. While information in this blog is discussed in the context of numerous conditions, it can be dangerous to take action based on any information in this blog or to start any health program without first consulting a health professional. The content found here is for informational purposes only and is in no way intended as medical advice, as a substitute for medical counseling, or as a treatment slash cure for any disease or health condition, and nor should it be continued as such. Always work with a qualified healthcare professional before making any changes to your diet, prescription drug use, lifestyle, or exercise activities. This information is provided as is, and the reader slash viewer assumes all risks from the use, non-use, or misuse of this information.